where we were there, we should be able to raise that. Findings and recommendations should not take long. Now, anything that we see there, where we are, or can we move?
I think if they say the company didn't require permit from the Etegwin Metropolitan to store dangerous chemicals in the area, I don't know whether that falls under the Etegwin municipality or provincial environmental health practitioners, because hazardous substances, it's the act gives them powers to run with the hazardous substance act and its implementation.
I'm not hearing you. What is the what are you contesting? The municipality.
Yes, it must be checked whether they get this thing from the municipality.
They must check that. Yes.
Yes.
Note that. Any other and the bullets here? Let's move to the move up.
Can we come back to the inventory, Chair? It's not the follow the after that one. It's not the inventory. It's the material safety data sheet. MSDF, not inventory, material safety data sheet. Because if you say inventory, something else.
Noted, Honorable Singh.
Chairperson, just on that one, I might have missed this one. The committee was aware of the reports of a number of these being banned in more than 50 other countries. Now, I don't know which of our committee members raised that or how we make that statement, and I stand to be corrected. I might have walked out when that was said. Our finding committee was aware of the reports of a number of these being banned in more than 50 other countries. What are we saying there?
It's not from us.
Yeah.
Not from us, that one.
Okay, let's remove it if it is not from us. Okay. The next bullet, the committee observed there was an urgent need for UPL. The committee appreciated the operations. The committee was concerned that the company omitted their employment equity statistics during the presentation. Let's move up. Okay, can we now move to recommendations?
Chair, I think when you say the company didn't present well on their staff, because I remember we asked about the approved inspection authority and okay, but there's one that was there, although it's a They are coming in as consultants, but they were supposed to include them. There were so many specialists that were not included in their report that we found on site.
Yes, I think we note that. With that, can we move to recommendations? National provincial as well as the Etegwin municipality furnished the committee with a report on the company's standing. I think that one was raised there. Department as well as UPL must furnish committee. What is that now? The committee all. I think you correct that.
I think.
All assessments and investigation reports. Must finish the committee all assessments, but the chairperson, there's no time frame. You know, we have to put
time
something
frames, I think generally.
I, Yeah.
Prescribed. Yes.
Yes, because we can't just say when they are completed, because they might take 1 year to complete.
So include
as a matter of urgency.
Normal time frame, yes. Time frames that we know. Let's move up. Let's stop there.
Chair, I think also we need a report from different departments, because when it was reported that time, it was only the report from the Department of Provincial Environmental Affairs. So each and every department...
Is that a new point?
Yes.
I think they are noting it. If it must come at the bottom there, the multi-stakeholder forum be set up. I think where we said it should be inclusive.
They call it JOC. But
yes.
Each and every department must write their report on this specific issue.
No, it's written already there, this Joint Operations Committee. UPL, anything there?
Yeah, Chair, I think that one, as we discussed this report today, UPL have responded, but really I haven't had the time to go through all those responses, and I don't think all our committee members, and we reserve our rights to respond to those responses, something like that. Because at the time this report was drafted, we hadn't received anything from UPL, but now, just this morning, we received something. Very scanty responses. So I think we must reserve our right to go through those responses and have another discussion on those responses. But just note that we received responses at the time of drafting of this report, which we haven't had a chance to go through.
Let's note that. Then the bullet on subs, nothing. Department should submit a report on progress made towards sending investigation reports from NG.
Yeah, that was a matter related, Chair, but not directly.
Not directly to this,
but
somebody who raised yes. something for engine in that
yes.
meeting.
Yes.
Yes,
but let's follow up on that. Yeah.
We raised the issue of engine because it's related to this incident, and we never received some of the written response from some of the departments. I think it was read there in that meeting.
I think let's note that we must, because somebody raised it there, we must then follow up on this issue of engine. The Etekwini municipality, that bullet, anything there? Let's move up. Okay, Department of Health, anything there?
Chairperson, sorry.
Yes.
I see the Department of Health should conduct an analysis of the Hazardous Substances Act 15 to identify gaps and areas. I know I raised the point earlier when the UPL presentation said that all UPL products are registered in South Africa under Act number 36 of 1947. Now, surely we've got to look at that act and what the products are, because it was something that was mentioned by, and I've got the presentation here, by Mr. Boata. So what is this Act number 36 of 1947 that they seem to be relying on? We need to revisit that act, see what its contents are and whether there needs to be any amendments or revision to some act that was passed when we were not even born, the year before National Party took over.
Okay, let's have it included there. This is 1936. The last bullet, anything there?
Jefferson, this is one other issue I think that we might not have captured here. You remember when the presentations were made, they said that this was a special zone and, you know, there were certain concessions, etc. I think we need to put that into our report because the way they presented the fact that it's a special zone, they were trying to suggest that they don't have to comply with the number of issues. Now, we need to know as an environment committee, I mean, what are the exemptions that one gets in these special zones? Are there environmental exemptions that are given to companies? Because they did say it's part of a certain type of a zone. And I think Honorable Paulson raised that issue. If he's still there, I don't know if he'd want to say something about it.
Honorable Paulson.
Yes, Chairperson, I think it's useful to note that many of the necessary environmental regulations were relaxed for UPL to set up this facility as part of the government's economic stimulation program. And they are under the impression that as it was relaxed when at the initial stages, that they never had to go and make sure that they comply. I don't think that was the intent of the initial relaxation of those requirements. And it's very important to note that even though it may have been that they were told that afterwards they can go and meet with those requirements or do whatever is necessary to meet with those requirements. So I think we still have to monitor whether they actually implemented or plan on implementing any of those requirements.
I think drafters, let's coin something that talks to this in terms of our recommendations. This thing that talks about special zones. Honorable members, we have taken a time to go through this with all the noted issues. Can we then get a proposal for the adoption of the report with the reservation that says on areas where we still want to go through the responses, we reserve our right to do so.
Chair, yes. Get there. I have two other concerns. Yes. The largest one of that is with this oversight visit, we were sort of bolting the door or closing the door after the horse had bolted. However, UPS have a number of other storage facilities in the Durban area, also located next to rivers. And what I'd like to propose is that those other premises and I'm aware of three of them at the moment where chemicals are stored, that those premises be inspected for the correct compliances by the end of the month and that we receive a report to the committee on those inspections within the next 2 or 3 weeks. We cannot allow the same disaster to occur. And unless those premises are inspected for compliance for public health and safety, for dangerous goods, for the EIA, and also for health and safety for the employees, we're going to have a problem. So please, I would like that added.
Honorable Phillips, a valid point. Let's put it, but I think what we'll need to refine is the time frames. When I say refine, I think there are some prescribed when you say by end of the month, I don't know whether it's this, but let those drafters draft something that talks to inspection of the other facilities similar to UPL to check compliance. Then there must be a time frame for that. Okay.
I'm going to come here at my own cost.
At my own cost. Whose own cost now?
I am happy to accompany the teams. at my own cost that do the inspection?
That one, I don't know who is going to inspect. But let's put it as you are indicating, and see what comes out of that inspection. Yes, Honorable Mbatha. Yes.
Because it's part of my specialty. Can I be included if there's that chance? So that I can bring better information. Thank you.
I think what we are noting is that there must be inspection for compliance. We'll find out how it gets done. Now I'm saying, with all those amendments and comments and additions, can we then get a proposal for the adoption of the agenda, with the reservation as well that we still reserve our rights to follow up on the things that came late?
Chairperson?
Yes, Honorable Sir.
Chairperson, I trust the drafters have captured all the issues. I would say that yes, with the provision that it be circulated to us with the amendments later on. And if there are any concerns, members can raise them. But generally, I think the principle of the report encapsulates what our feelings are as a committee.
Thank you. Any second to that?
I second it, Gus.
Okay. It looks like then it's carried. The report is adopted. Maybe Honorable Bryant because he was not there. He thought we were very slow, but it must have been for a good reason. Now, can we move to the adoption of minutes? I hope we'll pick up some speed now in terms of our program. Page one of the minutes. Page one, page two, who is doing that now? Page three, Honorable Mbatha. Or your hand was up for some time ago.
It's been up
for something else. Okay. We are now on page three. Page four. At least with minutes, we should be faster. Page five. Page six. Page seven. Page eight. Page nine. Page ten. Page 11. Page 12. Page 13. So that's 13 of 13. Can we get a mover for the adoption of the minutes? Any mover for adoption?
I move. I move.
Thank you, Chair. I move for the adoption of the minutes.
Yes, any second?
I second, Chair, Honorable Mbatha.
Honorable Mbatha seconded. Honorable Mortise thirded. Let's then move to the next item. Next item is adoption of the third term program for 2021.
Chairperson?
Yes.
Chairperson, can I just raise one brief point on this? And I did mention it in the last meeting, but we do have a presentation scheduled for the 21st of September on the preparedness for the COP26 Climate Change Summit, which takes place at the end of October. Chairperson, we're sitting in a very important time at the moment with regards to our climate and taking into consideration the recent reports that have been put through. And if one looks at the protests that are taking place across the world with regards to climate and the fact that, you know, COP26 is happening at the end of October, I'd like to request that the presentation be brought forward to the 31st of August. I've looked at the agenda for that day. There are only two presentations, and one of them is actually from the Weather Service, which would be quite complimentary, I think, in terms of looking at climate change. The schedule for the 21st of September is actually a very full day. It's also a long way away in terms of ensuring that we are prepared. So it's just a request that we bring that presentation forward to our next meeting, which is the 31st of August, for discussion to ensure that we are properly prepared in the run-up to COP26 at the end of October.
Okay, I think we're noting that, but with that, can you propose adoption of the third term program?
Yes, Chairperson, with that taken into consideration, I then propose adoption of the third term program.
Okay. Any second? I'm making assumptions here that we have gone through this. I think I remember we did go through this. If there's anything.
Seconded, Chair.
Seconded. Then the third term program is adopted. Can we move to the next item? Where's the agenda now?
Chairperson, sorry. I just wanted to go back there to the program adoption of this report. No, the third term program.
Yeah.
I think it speaks about the adoption of the UPL report on the 31st of August, does it? Can they just flight that again? If we go to 31st August, adoption of the oversight report to Mhlanga. That is on the 31st of August. But then I see in our parliament program, we've got a report to be considered on the 25th of August, which is tomorrow. Now, which report is that? I think the table...
They must correct that. This Mhlanga report we have just adopted, so it can't be there. Then tomorrow, what is happening tomorrow?
I'm looking at the program, parliament program. We got consideration of reports, agriculture, land reform, and we got PC on environment, forestry, and fisheries, ATC August, and it doesn't give a date. Now, I don't know if the suggestion was that the report that we've just adopted be debated tomorrow, because I see it on the program here. So I think the secretariat must just check with the table. Check with the table.
Yes. Who is speaking now?
It's myself, Chairperson. I hope it's myself.
Oh, Honorable Mortis. No, I'm battling. When I look at the participants, they take my screen. Honorable Mortis?
Yeah. No, the point Honorable Singh is raising is correct. But I want to quickly draw the attention of the committee back to the meeting of last week when you had a bit of problems with regards to your network connection. There were a number of amendments that we made. Ordinarily, we could have adopted this program in last week's meeting. We then agreed that we will push it forward to this meeting for adoption with the amendments that we have made. So without undermining the process, I thought we were going to look deeply into the amendments that have been proposed. One is that one that is that Honorable Singh is raising. It is correct, Honorable Singh. After the adoption by the Portfolio Committee today, tomorrow it is the debate in plenary of the reports, including Ushanga report. Secondly, is the proposal made by Honorable Bryant. It was raised in that meeting that for us to adopt this program term, this term program, the COP, the preparations of the COP should be encapsulated. And there are many others, and I deliberately ignored that there are a number of other resolutions that we have taken from our meeting, and they are not being implemented. And I think this is a concern that we must express ourselves once and for all, and it should never happen again. Thank you very much.
I suspect the two, Honorable Bryant's one, it must be captured, and I think the correction as well in terms of the adoption of the Mhlanga one and the debate must be corrected. I assume that if there's any other issue, Honorable Whip, it can still be accommodated. I don't know what else is, but we want to adopt the third term program with whatever amendments. If there's any specific issue besides the two that you have raised.
Chairperson?
Yes.
Chairperson, if we are still in the process of looking into this program, there is also an outstanding request to review the Greater Limpopo Transfrontier Agreement, which was a request that was put in during our visit to the Kruger Park. If that could be considered for inclusion at some stage near the end of our program, that would be most welcome. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay. With those amendments, can we, you proposed, Honorable Bryant.
I suppose I will then, I'll then re-propose with the additional amendments.
Okay. Then Honorable Mortis have seconded you. The third term program is adopted. Can we move to the next item in the agenda? Can we fly the agenda? Okay. Now it's we are now taking responses by the department on their intervention taken by the department to ensure compliance by ESCOM and SASOL with environmental laws. Can I assume now that Deputy Minister, you are taking over. Can I hand over to you?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to yourself and members of Parliament. Good morning to DG and the officials from my department. Chair, we are joined by our DG, Tshabalala, together with a team from SANParks, which is led by Dr. Ziba. The team from SANParks is going to lead us with regard to the fourth quarter performance and financial reports 2020-2021. This specific item we'll be dealing with now. Dr. Khumalo is the GDG responsible for climate change and air quality management. She's the one who's going to take us through with regard to what is on the screen now. That is SASOL ESCOM compliance report. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thuli?
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Good morning, Deputy Minister, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I am going to take you through this presentation as the M has said, but next slide, please. I just want to start with the legal background on the minimum emission standards. As instructed by the legislation, Minister had to publish a list of activities that result in significant atmospheric emissions. And this is called Section 21, Minimum Emission Standards. And it was gazetted first in 2010, and there have been several amendments over the years. With this legislation, the plans are defined into two parts. There are new plans, which are plans that the legal definition is that all plans whose environmental authorization was not approved on the 1st of April 2010 will be regarded as new plans. And any other plant that was either in operation or had an EIA approved before that date is an existing plant. And so in terms of the legislation, the new plants have a set of standards to comply with that is set. And then the existing plants had two sets of standards. The first one was for compliance on the 1st of April 2015, which gave them 5 years from the date of promulgation. And on the 1st of April 2020, they were supposed to have invested and comply with the new plan standards. This was meant to be a transitional arrangement because most of the plans were already in operation when the legislation was set, was promulgated. Next slide. So the Act itself provided for this, which we call postponement provisions, to enable plans to invest and to be given time to invest for compliance. In this regard, in 2015, ESCOM and SASOL applied for postponements and they were granted postponement decisions between 2015 and 2020. And then there were also decisions that were valid between 2020 and 2025 with respect of the legislation. These postponements were also updated when they made new applications in 2018 as a result of some of the implementation challenges that were said to have been encountered, and I believe that ESCOM and SASOL have shared that with the committee last week. Next slide. So in the interim that the legislation was being implemented between 2015 and 2010, there was evidence that some of the for example, plans used to just apply for postponements over and over again. And so the legislation was amended to put a stop to this, to indicate that there will be no postponement that will be valid beyond the year 2025, and to make a provision for plans that would be decommissioned by 2030 to not have to comply with the new plan standards, but to make sure that they comply with the existing plan standards until such decommissioning has happened. And thus, both ESCOM and SASOL made application for further postponements according to the challenges that they were experiencing during the implementation phase. For example, some of the technologies has to be designed in SA because there are no similar plants anywhere in the world that they could just take and fit, as they would have explained to the committee last week. Next slide. So as part of their postponement applications, commitments were made, and each one of the postponement decisions was attached to each of the commitments. So with every postponement decision, there was a roadmap attached to it that the department could use to monitor progress to see whether they were going to meet their commitments as stipulated. And so they had to be reporting the progress on a quarterly basis to the department. And also, the postponement decisions for them to be effective were included in the atmospheric emission licenses, which are being monitored by the licensing authorities, and where this, which are mostly the district municipalities. So, for example, Waterberg District Municipality monitors the Eskom Medupi, and Kangala, Hatsiba, and the Fezile Dabi for Eskom Letabo, and City of Cape Town and Buffalo City for some of the Eskom power stations. So we just to indicate that we do work together with the licensing authorities on this. Even the legislation itself requires that the National Air Quality Officer must concur with the licensing authorities in making these decisions. And then they are then effected in the atmospheric emission license and monitored together with normal license management of the AAF. Next slide. So the decisions were, that were issued in 2015 were for the 2015 emission standards, which I indicated earlier, and they were linked to offset projects, which I believe they were presented. Sasol went a long way in implementing their offset projects, but very little was done by Eskom in this regard. There's been very little progress, unfortunately, from Eskom's side in terms of meeting their 2015 compliance roadmaps, as they had acknowledged in slide 14 in their presentation last week. And just for the committee to note that Eskom NOx and transport dioxide emissions contribute 80% and 75% respectively of the total industrial emissions in the country. And so it is critical that this industry reduces NOx and SO2 emissions so that we can reach compliance with ambient air quality standards. Next slide. In this slide, Chair, I'm just wanting to indicate the legal provisions and what and the plans that had applied for that on Eskom side. So the legal provisions are in three parts. The first one is a once-off postponement application, which may not be valid for more than 5 years, and no postponement will be valid beyond 2025. If you look at the fact that the legislation was published in 2010 for the first time, we would see that the industry has been given 15 years to comply. The second part of the legislation is the suspension of compliance timeframes, which is applicable only to plants that will be decommissioned by 2030. And the requirement here is that they should be complying with the existing plant standards, not just emitting anything during that time. And then the last one is the alternative limits or emission load, which is for plants that would have made some form of investment towards compliance, but perhaps because the technology isn't functioning in South Africa as it does in other parts of the world, may not be reaching exact level of compliance that is required for the department to then look at what else could be done in that regard, with the provision that the National Ambient Air Quality Standards in the area of operation are being complied with, or where there are no standards for that particular pollutant, to ensure that the atmospheric impact report does not show material impact on the receiving environment. So if I go back now on the postponements, Eskom postponement applications for NOx were made for Kenda, Majuba, and Tutuga power stations. Eskom postponement applications for particulate matter were made for Duva, Kenda, Letabo, Matla, and Tutuga power stations. And Eskom suspension applications, which are the one where plants are going to decommission, were made for Acacia, Anot, Camden, Fruitfly, Hendrina, Komati, Krill, and Podrex power stations. Eskom also applied for alternative limits for SO2 for Duba, Kendal, Letabo, Majuba, Matimba, Matla, Medupi, and Tutuga power stations, and they also made application for particulate matter for Duba, Kendal, Letabo, Matimba, Matla, and Tutuga power stations. Next slide. So in terms of the legislation, no person will be valid beyond 31st of March 2025. That is there in the legislation, and that existing plans may be granted a suspension of compliance timeframe with the proviso that they will be operating at existing plant standards, which were applicable from the 1st of April 2015. And I have also spoken about this one of the alternative limit in the case that the technology is not meeting the exact number that is required by the South African law, but there must be proof that there has been previous investment towards that pollutant. And all of this, Chair, that these Eskom postponement decisions are still under consideration by the department. And the department also notes that the Eskom is doing a just transition plan and believes that it is central to the national just transition program, as you know, in terms of climate change. But it does not negate the need for Eskom to comply with the air quality minimum emission standards, as it is clear that these are in relation to protecting human health, because these air pollutants do have an impact on human health in the receiving environment. Next slide. This slide just summarizes, Chair, what has been applied for and our analysis in terms of the progress that is being made by SASO, which I believe was also presented to the committee last week. SASO has made good progress on SASO Secunda plans, and we do have monitoring programs there to ensure that they are complying and progressing with the investment as committed in the decisions and the applications they made to us. Similarly to the SASO bag operations, there is good progress being made. And I just note that with Natref as well, the time frame for application was shorter, but they did have a bit of delays due to some of the challenges they faced during the COVID-19 restrictions on construction activities. But in the midst of that, they still have made considerable progress towards compliance as indicated. Next slide. Perhaps just to explain a little bit here on the sulfur dioxide minimum emission standard, the existing plant standard for sulfur dioxide between 2015 and 2020 is 3,500 milligrams per normal meter cubed. That was for all existing plants. And these plants are expected to comply with the new plant standards of 1,000 milligrams from the 1st of April 2020. This, in effect, means that 58% of the sulfur dioxide must be reduced from the current emission, from the then emission of 2,500, which will result in significant improvement in air quality in the region. Maybe to note that oxides of nitrogen and sulfur dioxide contribute to the formation of PM2.5 and ozone in the atmosphere. And the current state of air shows non-compliance with these two pollutants. And so it is critical to have both SASOL and Eskom reduce emissions of this so that we can reach compliance in the future for the ambient air quality standards. And of course, if they continue to operate at current levels, we are not likely to reach compliance in the future. Next slide. Perhaps DM, I can hand over this one to Vanessa.
Thank you, Tilly. Good day, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, Deputy Minister and colleagues. I will hand over to Francis Craigie, the Chief Director Enforcement, to take us through our slides on compliance and enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. So just to provide the committee with an overview of the compliance and enforcement activities in relation to Eskom and SASL. These first few slides are just to provide confirmation again as to the roles and responsibilities around compliance and enforcement. So We know that within the Constitution that there is concurrent national and provincial competency around environment and pollution control, but that air pollution specifically falls within the domain or the mandate of local authorities. And so it is quite important just to understand those roles as we move into speaking about our contribution to compliance and enforcement. So if you move to the next slide, it just sets out the rationale for municipal environmental management inspectors. It is important, as I said, to ensure that there's effective performance by the municipality of their functions in respect of Schedules 4 and 5 of the Constitution. And so it was important for us to commence with a project to develop that environmental compliance and enforcement capacity at a local authority level, which we have been doing since 2010. Currently, there are about 405, I think, municipal EMIs sitting within different local authorities. And generally what happens in this case is the MEC in each province signs an implementation protocol with the executive mayor of that specific local authority. You can move to the next slide. Within Working Group 4, which is our MINTEC Working Group 4, there is a project where we continue to support those local authorities. So the National Department provides the national framework for the training, designation, and operation of the local authority EMIs. The provincial environment authorities are then the designating authority for those local authority EMIs. And they also provide the primary coordination and support to them within their respective provinces, while the local authorities themselves are responsible for developing appropriate human and financial resources in order to execute their EMI functions. And in this case, that would be in terms of the National Environmental Management Air Quality Act. And there's that number that I mentioned earlier, 405 local authority EMIs have been designated across 72 different municipalities within South Africa. So moving on to work, you can move to the next slide. With regard to us as the National Department working together with both the province and the local authorities, we have a number of projects that we then focus in on specific sectors, and one of them being ESCOM. And so this slide, the next couple of slides will show you the action that we have taken from a compliance and enforcement perspective as the National Department together jointly with a province and municipality. So with regard to Kendall, you'll see that this facility was first inspected in December of 2015, particularly around the non-compliances and emission limit exceedances. And then there were a number of enforcement actions over time. So you'll see firstly in October of 2016, then November 2018, and then the 14th of August 2019 was the most current intervention, with a final compliance notice being dated December of 2019, where the notice required the shutdown of units 1 and 5. At that time, we also initiated a criminal investigation in relation to Kendall. The slide indicates the next court appearance was on the 20th of August. That has actually happened, and the matter has now been postponed until the 14th of January 2022 by the court, and that is in order for ESCOM to make detailed representations to the DPP's office. Below that, you'll then see the outcomes, initiatives, and action plans that were then put in place as a result of our enforcement action. So I won't go into detail, but you will recall ESCOM did report on some of these interventions, and many of them have resulted from the different notices and enforcement actions that we took over the years. If you move to the next slide, this shows you Letabo. Again, just giving you a timeline in terms of the different enforcement actions taken. From 2009 through 2011 to 2013, with the most recent inspections then happening in 2016 and 2019. With regard to the most recent inspections, a pre-compliance notice was issued in May of 2020, with certain representations and improvement plans coming through to the department up until March of 2021. And we're now in the process of making a decision in terms of final enforcement action for Letabo. If you move to the next slide, very briefly, we then touch on the different the other facilities that we are involved with. So Camden, again, you can see there were different enforcement interventions, 2012, 2013, and 2018. Tatuka also over time in 2016, 2017, 2019, and we've actually issued a final compliance notice to Tatuka in May 2020, targeting dust-related matters, amongst others. We also, in this current financial year, 21-22, are taking enforcement action in relation to Grootvlei Duva as a result of certain information that came through. If you move to the next slide, then in relation to Sasol, specifically Natref, again, you can see over time we have been doing compliance monitoring work. First inspection happened back in 2015 with a pre-compliance notice in August of 2016. And then you can see there were different action plans that were provided over time. So a lot of the interventions that have happened at Natref to deal particularly, for example, with SO2 emissions, PM emissions, et cetera, the installation, for example, in the second to last bullet point of the electrostatic precipitator, all of these things have happened as a result of the compliance and enforcement action taken back in 2016. And then if you move to the next slide, this just deals with Sasol Sasolburg. Again, giving you a timeline from when we had taken certain inspections. We had then taken enforcement action in 2016 and 2017. And again, as a result of those 2017 enforcement notices, you can then see the outcomes, initiatives, and action plans that were then put in place. Obviously, where postponement applications are granted, then it means that we continue to monitor compliance and can only enforce against the emission limits that are in the AELs. And then I think the next slide is my last slide with regard to Sasol Secunda. You will see that there have been more recent enforcement action taken here, specifically as a result of the complaint that was reported through to the South African Human Rights Commission. It specifically touched on water issues around the Vaal River. The site investigation was conducted in April of 2021. Criminal docket was registered, as you can see there, and currently the matter is still under investigation with witness statements from all relevant role players being obtained at the moment. And there you can see the potential charges. So in addition to issues around pollution and waste, there are issues also around emission of air pollutants and contravention of the AELs. Thank you, Chair. I think those are the slides related to compliance and enforcement. I'll hand back to Dr. Kumalo. Thank you.
Thank you, Francis. I think on my side, let me now just take the committee through the legal provisions in terms of the air quality management plans. The Air Quality Act makes provision for the minister to declare areas, national priority areas, where there are non-compliances with the national ambient air quality standards, or where the minister believes in the future such will be the case. In this regard, the Vaal Triangle priority airshed area was declared on the 21st of April 2006 and the Highveld one in 2007. There is also the Waterberg Bujanala priority area, which I'm not going to talk about in today's presentation. Once the minister has made this declaration, there must be air quality management plans that are established in these areas, targeted interventions, and to focus resources on the reduction of air pollution in the priority areas. In this regard, in 2009, the AQMP for the Vaal was established, and in 2012, the AQMP for the Haifa priority area was established. Once these AQMPs have been published and are under implementation, we then conduct midterm review studies, which are meant to look into the implementation plans that have been put in place and to see whether the interventions therein are being implemented and to track the progress thereof, also to ensure that if there are some challenges or areas that need improvement, those improvements are then implemented at that time. So we did those midterm review studies. However, in 2013, a decision was taken to develop a second generation air quality management plan for the VAR, and the similar decision to develop the second generation air quality management plan for the Highveld was taken in 2017. This process of establishing second generation plans is preceded by a number of studies before we can actually get to the point where the air quality management plan is published for public comment. I'm going to explain these preceding studies in the next slide. Next slide, please. So on this slide, I have put a table to just show the comparison between the two air quality management plan second generation processes. So the first studies that we did was to conduct a air pollution impact analysis, which the Department of Health referred to as a health study. This study was conducted between 2013 and 2016 in the Vaal Triangle Airshow Priority Area, 2016 and 2019 in the Highveld. So as we also do what is called source apportionment studies, where we look at the pollution itself and work it backwards to the contributors. And this helps us to then develop targeted interventions for each one of the pollution sources that we may have found to make big contributions. The VAL one was done in between 2018 and 2019, and we have just embarked now on the SPA one between 2021 and 2023. So just on the health impact studies, we look at the health profile of the people at the time with the view that as the air pollution improves, we would to come back and find that the health profile has improved. I have spoken about the midterm review studies. I'm not going to repeat explanation on this. And so once we have done this work, we then publish what is called a baseline assessment report, which it puts in context all of the pollution and the status quo that we found, and we share this report with stakeholders. Just also to mention that the air quality management plan process is a stakeholder process. So the VAL one was completed in 2018 and shared. It is expected that the Highveld baseline assessment report will be completed by the end of this financial year. The plan was then published at the VAL in 2020 for public comment, which is where all the studies that I have spoken about would then be reflected in the air quality management plan. And we expect that the HPA plan will be published for public comment at the end of the next financial year. In terms of the VAL ATMP, Minister has already approved its publication after public consultation and consultation with her other cabinet colleagues in terms of the legislation. We are just at this point concluding processes with the government printers to publish the report, because it's quite a big report and it takes a while to get the quotations and everything that is associated with that. But we believe it will soon be published. We have also sent through the air quality management plan that was published on the 12th of June for ease of reference of the committee. We usually publish the air quality management plan, the final one, after 6 months of public participation, because this allows the stakeholders to work on the report and give us comments, and we can then conclude for Minister to promulgate the final plan. Next slide. Just to focus a little bit on the studies that have been referred to as health studies and what those studies aim to do on our part. They specifically look at the exposure of the population under study to ambient air pollution, which in the valley would be those local areas, to look at the exposure to air pollution. And secondly, they look at the potential health risks and impacts of that exposure. And thirdly, they look at the measured health outcomes and risk factors, which is how common air quality related symptoms and diseases in vulnerable communities are reported. The studies consist of three parts, namely the human health risk assessment, community health surveys, and child respiratory health surveys. These are very localized studies with small samples of the population under study within the areas that we look at. And so they do not indicate a national health profile or a regional health profile for that matter. And they are used as an input into the policy instrument, which is the air quality management plan that I was just reflecting on. Next slide. Just to give an example on this slide of what the air quality management plan itself will say as part of the health study that was conducted. So it does say that an assessment of impact was conducted in the VAL, and the study was comprised of the three parts that I have just explained. The study showed that the communities are at a high risk of acute and chronic health effects due to the exposure of particulate matter, oxides of nitrogen, and sulfur dioxide. The results also showed a relatively low prevalence of reported respiratory illnesses. Most respondents perceive their health and that of their households to be good. The prevalence of pollution-related bronchitis, pneumonia, lung infection, cancer, and pus from the ear were all below 1%, and the prevalence of chronic cough and wheezing was around 3%. And this can be seen in the study. I believe we circulated the draft AQMP for the committee. Next slide. We have, we're almost concluding the Heifeld study, but we do have, because we've started with the AQMP development now, we do have some high-level conclusions, which will also be reflected in the air quality management plan. The study followed the same paths as I indicated earlier, and it shows that the communities are at a high risk of acute and chronic health effects due to exposure of particulate matter, oxides of nitrogen, and sulfur dioxide. The results, however, suggested a higher prevalence of respiratory illnesses amongst school-going children. And the health study results will be incorporated in the second generation air quality management plan, which is currently underway. The baseline report will be published for public comment at the end of the next financial year. And so this will be reflected in that study. At this point, Chair, I'm just going to ask that Jongi takes us through the climate change mitigation slide that also talks to how we continue to regulate Eskom and Sasol with respect to atmospheric emissions on the climate change side. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thanks to the DM. Good morning, Honourable Chair. Good morning, Honourable members and colleagues. Yes, so far we've been dealing with air quality aspects. Now we also talk about climate change mitigation, dealing with emissions reduction. In this particular case, specifically from industry. So we have two regulatory instruments that we use to manage emissions from industry, greenhouse gas emissions from industry. The first one is what we call the carbon budgets. These are nothing more than what we call allocations of emissions to specific sectors of industry and specific companies. This particular instrument up to now is still a non-mandatory instrument because we are waiting for the Climate Change Act to be promulgated. Once that is done, it will become a mandatory instrument. The second instrument that we use is what we call mitigation plan. The mitigation plan captures actions from specific companies which are aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Both instruments operate in what we call five-year commitment periods. So up to now, we have just finished the first commitment period, which is what is in terms of the graphic that you see there, what we refer to as phase one on the left of the diagram. That first commitment period ran from 2016 to 2020. So companies had to be assigned voluntary carbon budgets. They also had to submit mitigation plans. So that period is over. In 2021, we are currently reviewing performance reports that companies have submitted, indicating how they've met their targets for that first commitment period. Then on the right side of the diagram, that is what we're referring to phase two. So in phase two, for the first time, we will have both the carbon budgets and the mitigation plan acting as mandatory instruments to regulate emissions, greenhouse gas emissions from industry. As I indicated, Chair, we are just waiting for the Climate Change Act to be promulgated. What that means, Chair, is that now, as we speak, we are in the middle of that diagram, what we refer to as the transitional period. There are three things that we are doing in this transitional period. The first one I've already mentioned, which is to review the performance reports of the first commitment period. We are also extending the voluntary carbon budget period for the simple reason that companies need certainty in terms of what they need to do to reduce emissions for this period. So we will be allocating carbon budgets to them for a period going from 2021 to 2025. Those carbon budgets will be reviewed just before 2023 as the carbon budgets will become mandatory. We are also allocating mitigation plans for the same period from 21-22, which will also be reviewed before 2023. The last thing that we are doing, Chair, is to provide methodological guidance. You'll recall, Chair, sometimes in February this year, we did present to the Portfolio Committee on that subject, indicating exactly how under the mandatory regime we are going to allocate carbon budgets to companies using a consistent, robust, and accurate carbon budget allocation methodology. Because in the first phase, it was rather less robust and voluntary at most. So that's more or less where we are, Chair, in terms of this. So this sort of gives the context. So for the first phase, only 40 companies participated. This is what we call big emitters. All of them emit more than 100,000 tons of greenhouse gas emissions per year. Our review as part of phase two is to lower a threshold so that we also have more companies that assign carbon budgets for the next phase. So we can move to the next slide. So specifically in terms of Eskom and Sasol, they obviously fall in the group of companies that emit more than 0.1 megatons or 100,000 tons of emissions annually. In terms of Eskom, for the voluntary phase, which was between 2016 and 2020, Eskom reported mitigation measures which were aimed at making their operations more efficient, for example, by running the less emitting, more efficient power stations. However, during the same period, due to challenges in terms of electricity demand and also subsequent load shedding, some of the inefficient stations were still utilized and estimated avoided emissions from mitigation measures were not necessarily realized in some cases. Eskom has also submitted its mitigation plan for the 2021-2025 period. That plan is currently under review by the department, and we have already provided comments to Eskom to address, mainly to make the mitigation plan more transparent, but also for traceability in terms of how the mitigation estimates from those measures are estimated, Chair. In terms of Sasol, for the first commitment period, that is between 2016 and 2020, Sasol had a series of interventions that are also aimed at reducing emissions. Some of them include, a heat integration project at the gas engine power plant that Eskom has at the Sasolburg plant, that is making more efficient use of heat that is generated in their processes, recovering that heat for use elsewhere in the plant and therefore reducing the need for burning more fuel. Also, Eskom had an energy improvement roadmap highlighting areas where there's potential to reduce energy consumption. Then also in their vinyl chloride monomer plant, they had an energy saving project looking at, again, interventions to reduce energy use and, enhancing efficiency. Sasol also has submitted its 2021-25 mitigation plan, which is currently being reviewed by the department. And some of the measures that are targeted around nitrous oxide a reduction from nitric acid plants, the energy efficiency, as well as renewable electricity installation in some of their plants. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. That will be all on this presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can we then, honorable members, allow an opportunity for questions and comments?
Chairperson, honorable Bryant, when you get a chance.
Honorable Bryant, number one.
Singh.
Wazir.
Honorable Singh, number two. Can we move it that way, Honorable Bryant?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the presenters, and it's good to have this presentation today. It would have been better if we'd had it on the same day as Eskom and Sasol, but nevertheless, it is good to have the presentations. Chairperson, my question is to the presenters. In terms of the issues at Eskom, we know that they're only going to be able to actually reduce or get to net zero by 2050, at least. And the other thing that's very scary that came out of our presentation is that Eskom's only envisaging being able to achieve 57% compliance with the minimum emission standards within the next 4 years. Should the department not be holding them to a higher standard? 57% compliance is just not good enough. We have a climate crisis. We have Eskom, which is emitting, close to 40% of our overall emissions. And somehow we seem content with accepting, 57% compliance. I'd like to know from the officials what steps are being taken to make that target a little bit more ambitious. We should be aiming for 100% compliance within the next 4 years. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Singh.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. I just want to follow up on Honorable Bryant. Because we thank the officials for the report from the department, but it's very, very concerning that Eskom seems to be getting away with minimum of minimum emission standards, which I think Honorable Bryant has emphasized. But just to mention, I think from the report that we've received, Sasol seems to be on track with innovative methods to reduce air pollution, et cetera, et cetera. But the big concern is Eskom. And I'm worried about these postponements. I mean, we heard very clearly from Eskom the other day that their problem to meet standard was largely around financial issues. Now, if you juxtapose the health risks, which a presentation also revealed to us, for example, in the high felt and other areas, now if you juxtapose that, the health risks and the finances, I mean, something's got to be done somewhere. And I think the Department of Environment is in the best place position to ensure and enforce compliance through legislation, which brings me to the second question, Honorable Chairperson, and that is the EMIs, the Environmental Management Inspectors. I note that there's 405 in 72 municipalities, and they say they have been capacitated. To what extent are they fully capacitated? To what extent are their enforcement on some of these companies, especially Eskom, Sasol, and the other big companies? And has there been any prosecutions of non-compliance with these regulations? I mean, it seems to me that it's a never-ending problem. And the least important in all of this are communities. Surrounding communities, the health risks posed to surrounding communities and other risks. I mean, Durban South Basin is a classic example, Mpumalanga, Highveld, et cetera. And I don't think we are doing enough as a department. We're not wielding the big stick, but we're granting postponements, which I'd really like the department to speak to. Because if we don't, as the Department of Environment, do what is necessary to ensure a cleaner environment, then these companies will just continue going on and come with all kinds of reasons for non-compliance. Thank you, Chair.
Any responses, Ben?
Chair, I indicated that I have a question or two.
Oh, Honourable Paulson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I just like to know who advises the minister as to what should be a priority area. That's the first question. The next question is, when Eskom sets a target date for zero carbon emissions or reduced carbon emissions, how do we monitor, or are there any intermediate targets? Let's say you've got a 5-year term to reduce emissions. Are there any intermediate targets, and how are those targets, or how is it monitored as to whether the organization meets those targets? Thank you very much.
Any other hand? Okay, over to you, Deputy Minister, and your team.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks to honourable members. Dr. Khumalo and the team will respond to those questions and comments that has been made by members. Over to you, Dr. Khumalo.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Chair, I think the legal framework in response to Honourable Bryant around the 57% compliance, what we require as a department is 100% compliance. And I think the minister has been very clear on that one, even in her affidavit, responding affidavit in the Highveld court case, that we expect all industry to comply with the law. At this point, the Eskom applications are still under consideration, and they will be concluded and communicated to Eskom. But at no point did the department indicate that we accept 57% compliance. We do not accept 57% compliance. I think, Chair, the next one I will leave the one for EMIs for Francis and for Jong to talk to the net zero regarding Eskom emissions. But I will take the one that Honourable Paulson asked around who advises the minister to declare an area a priority area. Of course, Honourable Paulson, the minister has a team of experts in the department who advise this, but the legal framework is also very clear with regard to at what stage can an area be declared a priority area. One of the requirements, firstly, is that the ambient air quality standards in that area must be exceeded at that point, or there must be sufficient evidence for the minister to believe that in the future such should be the case. Secondly, for the MEC also has the same provisions within a province. So if the boundary of this area crosses provinces, the minister can then declare it as a national priority area. But if an MEC makes a request to minister to declare a priority area within a particular province, minister can then declare. Of course, minister must ensure that she has the resources to do that work, because it's quite a lot of resources. But Chair, I'm just saying the legal framework is there to guide at what point an area can be declared a priority area. And if any one of the requirements are not met, it may not be declared a priority area. Just to note that also, it's quite a resource-intensive process, and minister must also have the resources, even if she were to be requested by an MEC to do that work. Perhaps before we come to the specifics on AMIs and the compliance and enforcement, let's take the ESCOM one on net zero. Jongi?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks also to the DM. Yes, on the question raised by Honourable Paulson, firstly, we do have a web-based system now as we speak that monitors on an annual basis emissions mostly from industry. So they're expected, for example, to report by end of March of every year, reporting for the previous year. That system has been running for the past 5 years, so we know exactly the level of greenhouse gas emissions that entities emit. But in terms of instruments to set targets, so far as I reported, we have the what we call the carbon budgets. Those are, if you like, targets or assigned amounts to companies for them to reduce emission. The challenge that we have thus far is that the carbon budgets have been voluntary. So we need to have the Climate Change Act so that those targets can be mandatory, and that will assist a great deal. Then also, as part of the proposals under the Climate Change Bill, we are proposing the development of sectoral emission targets. These sectoral emission targets will then talk to policies, or at least be informed by policies and measures that assist with reducing greenhouse gas emissions. One of them is the IRP, or the Integrated Resource Plan, which deals specifically with electricity generation. There's a series of objectives and targets in that particular measure. For example, which talks to decommissioning of stations and other deployment of renewable energies and so on. We can quantify the implications of all those objectives and targets in terms of emission reduction, and that then becomes the sectoral emission targets. These will become operational once again once the Climate Change Act is in place. So that is the set of instruments that we have to manage greenhouse gases. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Let me come in on the compliance and enforcement issues, if that's okay at this stage. With regard to the EMIs and the extent of the capacity that exists at local authority level, I think, as I've mentioned, we do have a fair number of EMIs at local authority level across the country. They all go through what we call EMI basic training, which enables them to understand, obviously, the legislative framework, their powers and functions in terms of inspections, as well as their powers and how to undertake investigations and put together criminal dockets. There are also a number of specialized training that we give to EMIs. However, I think it is important to note that we are busy with a project currently under Working Group 4 to really look at the capacity sitting within each of the local authorities, because they are primarily responsible for air pollution and the issuing of AELs, obviously across the board, but also to ESCOM and SASL. And so we have picked up an issue, particularly in certain municipalities, around not necessarily that the ability to do the work, but the numbers of officials or numbers of EMIs that sit within some of these priority area municipalities. We've also had a number, for example, retiring, and obviously the younger people now come through. And so we've realized that we do need to understand the ability to do some of this work. As I said, in addition to the training program, these joint operations and joint compliance and enforcement interventions enable us to do on-the-job training with both the provincial and local EMIs together with the national EMIs. Come together and actually work on these cases together. As I said, however, the role is a local authority role, and therefore generally where the national department gets involved is where they are asked to come in and actually lead the investigation. So, for example, on ESCOM Kendal, where there is a criminal investigation and there is a criminal case in court currently, we were asked as the national department to come in and play a lead role in terms of that investigation. And in a way, this is a test case for us. And it is quite important that once you start criminally prosecuting, it's not just a case of trying to prove that there were exceedances in terms of the limits of a license. You have to also collect enough evidence to prove things like mens rea, which is, did they have the intention or negligence that is required in terms of a criminal court? And can you prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there were certain things that took place? And so it does increase the complexity of these investigations, but we are busy now, as I said, with Kendal We are gearing up for another specifically criminal investigation around certain of the aspects of Eskom's operations. But it is complex because, you know, what is the outcome of these types of cases? Is it the payment of a fine potentially? Do you then decide to go after directors in their personal capacities? And there's decisions that prosecutors really need to make around a lot of these issues. And as I said, particularly with regard to the case that is in court with Kendall, they do now have an opportunity to make representations to the Director of Public Prosecutions around certain of these matters. So I thought, let me just touch on those issues, but to assure the committee, you know, that we do have a process underway to really understand the capacity and to put in place even more measures to try and build up the local authorities' capacity to do compliance and enforcement around these aspects. Thank you.
Is that the end? I assume that's the end.
Yes, Chair.
Okay. Thanks. Can we then, if there's no follow-up, any follow-up from honourable members?
Chairperson?
Honourable Singh?
Yeah, Chairperson, sorry. Yeah, I think it would be a good idea if we get regular updates from our own department on these issues, like Honourable Paulson has suggested, whether targets are being met and whether there is a lag in targets so that we don't wait, you know, till 2025 to find out whether some of these companies have complied or not. So I think we must make it a quarterly item or a six-monthly item or something like that. Thank you.
Noted. I think with that, then we can move to the next item, which would be, in terms of the agenda, presentation by the joint presentation by the land claimants on their complaints raised during the Portfolio Committee oversight visit to Kruger National Park, both from Limpopo and Mpumalanga. I'm told the presenter, who is already logged in, is Mr. Perry Pambo. Can we welcome you, Mr. Perry Pambo, and hand over to you to take through the Portfolio Committee. Over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, everyone in attendance, particularly the honorable members and my colleagues who are part of this meeting. A point of correction, it's not Pambo, my surname is Sambo.
Written wrongly.
No, thank you. I'm saying this for record purposes. Thank you, Chair. I will try by all means to try and conduct the presentation, hoping that members have had the privilege already to go through it before it's presented today. However, I wish to apologize for some redundancy that is appearing and a slight confusion on the layout of this presentation. I'm presenting on behalf of both Limpopo and Mpumalanga, since our frustrations are similar. After broad consultation, we reached that agreement like it was previously when we presented at Skukuza. I'm representing Mahashi with the permission of the following: the chairperson Elvis Fakude, Mutlanganesen is for myself, then Ngirivana Amos Machebula, Madonsi Wilson Chiauke, Muyeshe, Dr. Ben Sungwane, who will today be represented by Eddie Setole because he's not well. A brief background that I would like to give before I get to the actual presentation, it's the manner in which this Kruger claim has been processed. there have been a lot of exclusions that took place since the beginning of the negotiation until it was at reached the settlement stage. So the background that I'm going to give should allow members to see the immense frustrations we are under, what we are going through as Kruger National Claimants. If you would check, since 2016, after the signing of the settlement agreement, the handover, and nothing has moved so far. So hence the historical background that I'm presenting to you as the start of our presentation. It is worth noting the plight of the land claimants of the Kruger National Park as a shame and a mockery in the manner in which the negotiations and settlement process unfolded. With the land claimants in Kruger National Park, want to put this on record. One, the land claimants were completely excluded from all the settlement and negotiations, which deprived us of the opportunity to for fair participation on matters affecting our rights and future. We believe this was purposefully done to deny the claimants of their rights on land. This is equal to disposition in the name of correcting the past injustices our people suffered in those years. We, the land claimants in Kruger National Park, strongly view this matter as a bad receipt for the future land claims in the country, and a challenge to the envisaged land redistribution program underway by government. The process was never inclusive of the claimants, but every decision was imposed, and which now becomes a problem. And we therefore say this is justice denied. This approach has eroded and undermined the democratic rights in Kruger National Park land. This matter requires urgent attention of government and engagement with the land claimant leadership. Hopefully, now that we're presenting to the government, it will be taken into serious consideration that something be done about it. The Land Claimants Commission has been unwilling to engage with us on this matter, despite several requests for meetings to try and look into how the process unfolded, which now becomes or creates problems for us as land claimants. From the look of things, there has not been good intentions in settling Kruger claims. The decision to impose has created serious problems for the land claimant communities. It does not spell clear future identity of these land claims in Kruger. Quite sad to note that more land is required for incorporation into Kruger National Park, where dignified agreements shall be entered into, but not with us as the original land claimants of Kruger. This proves that the bestowing of rights in our case was possible, but government overlooked and undermined that route. So we therefore appeal to government for that attention. We believe we share equal footing with Sunpark and Kruger National Park because we both have equal interests. They have an interest to protect, much as we also have an interest to participate or do activities on our piece of land we have claimed. We also want to record that no model was provided. I hope you remember as Parliament when they indicated the beneficiation scheme should be developed. There has never been a framework or model to that effect. So hope that has led to this confusion that we find ourselves in. We fail to see any good intentions in settling this land claims in Kruger National Park as a result of all these processes which have excluded most of our people, like particularly our services claimants. Two, in 2002, there has been a cabinet memo which was designed. Going through it, it looks like a reasonable guiding document towards the settling of land claims in contested areas. We're happy with that. Over and above, another cabinet memo in 2008 was designed specifically for the Kruger National Park. The big question is why? Because it had taken almost all the rights that we're supposed to have as claimants in Kruger National Park. We will continue to be noisy but we'll do it in a professional way to make sure government listens to us. So as a result of this, we would want that government to record to say all those rights that we thought we have are no longer there, and we request for the attention. And furthermore, we also want to record that these cabinet memos were kept secret all the time until only in May 2018. You can imagine 2016 when we signed and the handover was conducted without this document being presented to us to see what is it that was being followed to have such a settlement expected. This approach will leave our communities with no future trace for land claims in Kruger National Park unless this was by design and purpose. The issue of the title deed was possible, and it could still be possible only if that is done under the registered notarial type deed, where now some restrictions are, you know, are put into effect. Would they respect that? So this approach that has already been undertaken has taken away the pride and dignity of our people, which is fundamentally incorrect. An unjust system cannot be justified by another of the same kind. We, the land claimants, support that Kruger National Park continues as a conservation area, but we refuse to find ourselves, you know, without any right on land where we could co-manage the park together. Under the verification process being now number three, this has left families in a state of conflict in the manner in which it has been carried out. So many families were forced into one fire, that is one household, even those who qualify to have their own families. So families are now fighting over this. Would love that that be looked into by government to find a way to have it resolved. Over the size, over and above, the size of the land claimed by each claiming community has been extremely reduced without explanation given to the communities. We have, you know, evidence to that with regard to the size of the land claim. To us claimants, there is no acceptable justification of this decision by cabinet or government. We strongly feel that this matter requires government attention through engagement with the land claimants to get it finally resolved. Since 2017, payments of financial compensation have not yet been finalized. It goes at a snail's pace, the reason not known, despite all attempts to always knock at the door of our commission's offices. This delay results in serious complications and prolonged transfer or payment in terms of the beneficiaries passing away while they're still waiting to receive their money. And then another one has now to receive. So it creates, you know, serious problems. And that must also be attended to. We then appeal to Parliament to try and contact the relevant office to speed up this so that we can see ourselves moving well on phase two. So on the beneficiation scheme negotiation, that's when now another problem, you know, cropped up. That it should be remembered that there has been no model provided by cabinet on the design of the beneficiation scheme. SANParks, who is supposed to be in partnership with the land claimants, and I indicated that SANParks has got equal interest, was given the authority to lead the development and implementation of the beneficiation scheme. We view this as a serious flaw on the side of the commission because of the interest it also has on land, that is SANParks. Since the signing and handover in 2016, the 18 months elapsed. It's more than 18 months now, counting back to the previous meeting with you at Parliament, where the land claimants equivocally reject the offer by SANParks, the 1%, you know, offer, and hence this led to a stage where we declared a dispute to say we cannot, you know, on such a piece of prime piece of land, receive 1%, which doesn't make any sense particularly that the different training communities have to share. A neutral body could have been the best option to lead the negotiations for the beneficiary scheme. As a result of the dispute lodged, Minister Barbara Christie intervened and a facilitator was appointed, but has since exited the process in July 2021 before engaging with the land claimants in terms of trying to find a resolution for the dispute that has been lost. However, we deemed it necessary to mention that as a result of this, our relationship with Kruger is gradually deteriorating. We are not consulted or informed when there is a new development underway. For an example, we only heard that there will be a short training for the Skubuza Safari Lodge, whereas we're there squarely on a piece of land, we're not consulted, and a new development for the Shalati restaurant. All this was surprises to us as land claimants. Next slide, 6. Benefits to land claimants. Since the signing and the handover in 2016, there has never been any benefit towards or to the land claimants from Sunpark. The briefing report, which was given on the 16th of March, shared by Sunpark with the PCEFF, does not give correct representation of the state of things in this regard. There are conditions set by Sunparks for the land claimants if they should benefit from Kruger, where they are saying we should sign for the beneficiary scheme that is still under development and which we are disputing so far. Community conflict, it is alleged that there are some senior officials moving around, participating in meetings with certain groups from our communities, causing conflict among the communities. So we strongly feel that this matter should be is investigated and be corrected so that we can restore peace and unity among our people. This kind of behavior by any official does not build towards the expected partnership. It is an automatic threat to the lasting relationship we aspire to create between the park and the communities. It is only in the presence of peace and unity where there will be progress. Recommendations. We recommend that concerns raised be positively considered by the committee, that the communities be funded on legal and transitional support during beneficiary scheme negotiation, that this be not our first and last engagement with this committee. This was raised previously also. That Parliament be made aware of the problem it has created for the communities. Though there is acknowledgement of the good things done for us, that the committee maintains the KNP beneficiary scheme development and implementation as a standing matter to hold the CRLR, DEFF and Sunparks accountable for progress for reporting, ensuring the community representatives are also represented on such reporting. However, on my last point, which is not captured here, but I need to really indicate that we moved to the point where we are because we had no legal representation, even on the day of the signing of the settlement agreement, where it took us more than 4 hours, refusing to sign, requesting for a legal, you know, assistance in interpreting the document, where a promise was made by the commission to say they're going to get us one. That has never happened. The only thing which was indicated was that we are going to be allowed to go back to the settlement agreement because there is a clause which speaks to the issue of amendment. That's when we agreed to sign, but no one is ready now. So that's the reason we say we are in a state of confusion and we feel very much frustrated as a result of all these processes that we feel did not go right. Thank you so much. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sambo, I want to be correct now.
Thank you,
Honorable members, that's the presentation. I'm not sure, Mr. Sambo, if there's anything I leave before I allow members. I see Honorable Paulson is number one. I see Honorable Zweliti Nison, Advocate Zweliti Nison. I don't know where he comes from.
He's a new member.
And then I see Dave Flint. He's a new. Then also it means I've not been given a proper.
An advocate from the community chair.
It's from the community. It's not Mr. Boko. God, I've forgotten Zoko or something.
Mr. Joko.
Joko. Honorable Bryant, you are number three. Can I take those for now? Honorable Paulson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson.
I'm sorry about that, Chairperson. I'm struggling to raise my hand with my new gadget. I just wanted to indicate that. no, Honorable Paulson. I just wanted to indicate that before just members then pose the questions that we have the Kruger National Park management in the meeting. We have about six of them led by the CEO. Therefore, it will be good then for members to pose those questions, and they will be in a position to respond to those questions. And lastly, Chairperson, after everything, can I also request that we get a copy of the presentation from the presenter so that a minister can have a look at that and see how best then we deal with some of the matters that has been raised. Thank you very much. Thanks, Honorable Paulson. Thanks, the chair.
Thank you, DM. Thank you very much, DM.
Honorable Paulson.
I put on my video because I want to show DM I'm wearing my same jacket that I've been wearing for the past 8 years. Chairperson, I not so much a question, but I have a comment or two, and I'd like to also have an idea as to what the size or the number of these land claimants are. And and then the comment I have is that we flew over Kruger National Park, wonderful. There's some billionaires who have nice homes there, and it's sad that our people who have a right to live in that park or to some land in that park are living on the outskirts in under horrible conditions. So. And I think this is definitely something that we should be paying a lot of attention to. Thank you very much, Chair.
Honorable Advocate Zwelithini Sono.
Thank you, Chair, and all the members in the House. I just wish to request clarity from the presentation that was made by Mr. Pepe Sambo, because he has indicated that he is representing both Limpopo and Mpumalanga. And I would want to know who has authorized him to do that, and where did he get the powers to be a representative of all chairpersons. But more so, is he representing chairpersons, or is he representing land claimant communities? If you can please clarify that. But further, we've got questions, especially on the fact that, as he has mentioned, there are claims and that and claimants that have not been paid. And for a fact, I know it's in Mpumalanga, which is a question we raised a long time ago on how they go to phase two and take decisions without having finalized the payments of claimants. But also, can you also clarify, is a chairperson of a land claims committee or is a chairperson of a community property association? In what capacity is he speaking? Thank you.
Maybe that's the first question we should be, because when I said he speaks on behalf of Limpopo and Mpumalanga, I thought there would be no such questions, but if they are there, honorable members, I think that we should start there first to, before I allow you to ask questions, so that you can clarify as Mr. Sambo, your credentials now are being questioned. Can we allow you, Mr. Sambo, to clarify that, those issues?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, everybody. I think under normal circumstances, in no way I could claim to represent people without the mandate. I initially indicated the chaplains for each claimant community. I think these are the right people we should be questioned about the decision that finally reached to where it is now, where I represent them. I think that's the best thing I can say. Chauke Wilson is representing Madonsi. Dr. Ben Shungwane is representing Yeshe, who is today represented by Edith Stone. These are the right people to answer. The second part of this question to say, very clear. If you have been delegated, obviously you have powers to can execute the delegated responsibility. So far, I think I can pause here, unless there is any further.
No, we wanted everything from you. If you think you have satisfied or whoever, whether those, you said those chairpersons are also part of this meeting?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. I can just request colleagues from Limpopo, if you manage to join the meeting, you can better respond to the question raised by Advocate John.
Yes. Hello?
Yes, I can see you there.
Yes, my name is Guba Zwibi, Richard Miyambo from Madonsi.
Madonsi.
Yes. We are the one who gave Mr. Sono who gave Mr. Sambo to do presentation, because all this presentation is the same. So we didn't want to take a long time, Yeshe, take 10 minutes, what such a thing like that, you know. So I fail to understand such a person like Advocate Zwelithini. Why did he ask that question? Because this is nothing to do with him. He have got his own agenda, which we suppose not to allow it here. So let us try to push this process accordingly. He have got his own agenda, and his own agenda, if we can allow it, we can take 2 to 3 hours debating on it. It's an agenda on its own. If he wants to bring his own agenda here, let's arrange with you so that we can come it for it. We can come here to debate about it. I thank you.
Thank you. Now, let me be satisfied. I just wanted to have a sense of what is going on. But you are right, Mr. Guvazwivi.
Yes.
To suggest that if Advocate Sono feels that there's something that we need to listen to as a committee, he's free to do so. The portfolio committee does have an ear. And so, but let's not focus now on the issue of, now let's leave Advocate Chauke. Let's focus on the questions now from members. But if there's any other issue that needs a focus, we will gladly accommodate that. Honorable Bryant.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I just want to firstly say thank you and welcome to the claimants, the representatives of the claimants present in the meeting today. I know we did meet some of them during our Kruger Park visit, and as I recall, and as is being the discussions today, this is a highly complex and highly complicated matter that has been, in the pipeline for. Do you hear me, Chairperson?
No, yeah,
Chairperson, hear me. Chairperson, you can hear me. Okay.
Yes. Now we can hear you now.
Okay, fantastic. Chairperson, my question specifically is with regard to a claim that was made repeatedly during the presentation, placed intentionally to prejudice the land claimants during this process, need to be interrogated. And I would like to have a response from the officials present around that, because it is quite a serious claim if it is true. And if it's not the case, then I think we also need to establish that. So I would very much like a response from the officials in terms of those claims around, an intentional prejudice being effectively to the process. Thank you.
Honorable Mbatha.
Chair, thank you.
Honorable, yes.
I think we might say Advocate Sono is out of order yet. I don't think it is out of order, because during our oversight visit in Kruger National Park, he was representing some of the communities. To me, I pick up that we need to be careful when communities come to present to us. We must verify first that all communities are represented, because if you look at the presentation, there are communities that have pulled out, so not all communities are represented in the presentation that is given today. And the other thing is that I know they say the land claims, they fall under Department of Agriculture. But I remember on that day, there were issues that not all the land, the claimants are being involved. There are decisions that are being taken behind their back. And there are also issues on decision making, and the most of the benefits they were claiming that it goes to the officials. So there were lots of things that were raised on that day. And now this thing happens now, it raised my concern to say this is not a a full representative of the community. And we need to investigate that so that we follow up, we can respond to all claimants that are the, on what is happening there. But I still remember a honorable person has raised the issue of the accommodation that was not up to standard. Although I left early, but I had that thing that there's the new, there was a new issue of revamping those areas. And the other one, the last one, I'm worried where the claimant, or when the claimant claimed they only, they are concerned about one person in the whole family. That will create unnecessary infight within the families. That needs to be looked at. I think we should also, as a PC, have a joint PC with the PC on environment, because they are leading this issue, so that we have a full insight of this on what is happening. I thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Singh.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think our colleague meant we must have a meeting with the PC on agriculture and land affairs. What you said, but I was not part of this trip, but the one area that I'm interested in, Chairperson, is there was reference to a facilitator by DFFE, and the facilitator is not there anymore, not playing the role. I don't know if the facilitator was withdrawn. I don't know if the Deputy Minister can tell us what happened about this facilitator and the circumstances that led to the withdrawal of the facilitator. Thank you.
Thank you. I think for now, let's allow the management led by the Deputy Minister to respond to some of the issues raised.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks to members. The team from the SANParks will respond to some of the questions. Some of the issues that has been raised, Chair, I would plead with yourself, because I requested for a copy, but they've just sent the copy to me. I would request that we get the copy with the management and work on it and try to respond to some of the issues that I'm 100% sure that they won't be in a position of responding to them. And then we'll come back to the committee with responses. With regard to the facilitator issue, Honorable Singh, unfortunately, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I don't have any information on that one, but I will then request the management to respond to some of the issues that are raised. But there's one issue that I think I need to respond on that I saw on the presenter's document, the issue of CAP memos. CAP memos are strictly for cabinet, and they are secret documents. They are not for public. But the product of those CAP memos is supposed to be a vast outcome of a certain consultation that has taken place. Maybe if they can say that some of the issues that they raised were not then taken by the department into whatever process. But when it comes to the CAP memos are not for everyone. It's strictly for cabinet members. Thank you very much, Chair. And then I'll give over then to the CEO, who can tell us who's then going to respond to some of the, and then if there are questions that we couldn't respond to, can I plead with yourself that can we do that in a written form? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
CEO?
CEO?
Thank you, Chair. I had raised my hand. Thank you, DM, for that introduction. Chair, we want to firstly express appreciation to the communities that we're presenting today, as represented by Mr. Sambo, and we appreciate the fact that they are raising these matters to the parliamentary, the portfolio committee on environment. And Chair, we also want to indicate that we take the matters related to claimant beneficiation as an organisation very seriously, because we believe that they are matters that need to deal equitably and justly with the issues of dispossession of communities. We do, however, realize that this matter is very complex, Chair, and so want to echo the request that has been made by the DM that we be given opportunity to study the matters raised by the communities here. Add that to our experience of engaging with the communities in the past, and come back and share with Parliament in writing, and perhaps even in a presentation where communities would also be present, our responses and views around some of these issues. Chair, I would like to request Mr. Ngali Nomthongwana, supported by Mr. Gareth Coleman. Mr. Ngali Nomthongwana is the acting head for socioeconomic transformation and SANParks, and Mr. Gareth Coleman is the managing executive for Kruger National Park, to provide specific responses to the questions raised by Honorable Bryant and Honorable Mbatha and Honorable Singh around the facilitator. Thank you, Chair. Mr. Nomthongwana.
Good afternoon, Chair. I think it's 12:05, yes. Members, honourable members, Deputy Minister and colleagues, and of course the community representatives. Chair, indeed, I can't re-emphasise acting so has said in terms of the complexity of this particular claim. And I think from Mr. Perry Sambo's presentation, he also alluded to a special cabinet memorandum which was developed in 2008, particularly to deal only with Kruger amongst all the 400 and something protected areas that we have in the country. So it's really complicated. And I think he also alluded to the fact that there was no precedent in terms of how this will be structured, and hence it needed all the different parties involved in terms of structuring it. So when we really entered into it, I think we were always aware that it was not going to be easy, but at the end of the day, we always wanted to satisfy everyone involved. So just to respond directly to the honorable member's questions, and the question was about size in terms of the land and as well as in terms of the beneficiary communities, I mean the claimant communities. Chair, Kruger is almost 2 million hectares in terms of size. The claims from the 15 claimants currently is sitting at close to 500,000 hectares. That actually constitute almost a quarter of Kruger National Park. This excludes the claim of Makuleke Contractual Park, which is 29,000 hectares in the northern parts of Kruger. And of the claimants that I've mentioned, the 15, only 7 have signed the settlement agreements. When you look at the number of beneficiaries in terms of the families, they are close to 1,500 that will benefit from the beneficiation scheme or that have benefited from the financial compensation to date. And I think the second question was the issue of whether there was always an intention to prejudice the claimants from when this claim was settled. Chair, and I think that's the matter that we always need to consult with the commission without being taking their responsibility here. Because the nature of settlement of these claims on protected areas is at two levels. There's a pre-settlement stage, which is led by the Commission in terms of Land Restitution Act. And there's also post-settlement, which is where SANParks and the Department of Environment and Fisheries actually come in terms of implementation of the settlement agreement. So I think from the presentation by Mr. Terry Sambo, I think the whole prejudice, as he indicated, even the negotiations leading to the settlement, signing of the settlement agreement. And I think that's the matter that I think from the Honorable Mbatha indicated that perhaps we need a joint sitting where there's also agriculture and land affairs present to be able to deal with that particular matter. And I think from the post-settlement activities, from SANParks perspective, our intention has always been to try to develop a beneficiation scheme that will be in line with the cabinet memorandum of 2008, as well as the settlement agreements as they are designed. And in that process, we had established what we call a project management unit, which is informed by the settlement agreement. Section 6.1 of all the settlement agreements indicate that there must be a project management mechanism that is utilized to design and develop the beneficiation scheme. In that particular unit, all the claimants' communities, except for one, that decided not to participate and participated in that. So that was the structure that was given a mandate by all the claiming communities to design a beneficiation scheme. The truth is what I think also Mr. Sono indicated, that we were not at the stage where everyone was happy with what was on the scheme as informed by the settlement agreement. It was always our position from then Sun Parks to say, if now the idea is to even include things that were not necessarily part of the settlement agreement, it will have to go back to the commission. And I think, Chair, that's where the problem is. And hence that joint committee may be necessary. And then, Chair, the other question was the issue of the I think I'm just looking at my notes now, of the facilitator. Chair, what happened was when we got to a stage where there was no agreement on some of the elements in the beneficiation scheme and with the claimants, and there was then a decision taken by a joint coordinating committee, which is led by the commissioner and the CEO of Sunparks, to appoint an independent facilitator, as indicated by Mr. Perry Sambo, that and their feeling was always, Sunparks has always been a player and a referee at the same time. So, and I think the agreement was then to finalize the scheme where all the parties are happy, perhaps an independent party is appointed. That process was led by the commission. Indeed, the independent facilitator was appointed for a period of 6 months. Unfortunately, Chair, and his contract actually expired without him concluding on this matter. And he has made some recommendation on his exit report. One of his recommendations is that given the nature of this particular claim and the passage of time that you don't need where there's no engagement, it's dangerous for the process. As a result, the commission must immediately consider appointing an independent facilitator to allow the continuity in the process. So I'm not sure, Chair, whether I've left any other point that were raised by the members. I think I've covered some of those that I felt were raised by the members. And we are taking into consideration what Dr. Ziba, in terms of us coming back and so that we can respond elaboratively and comprehensively on the many aspects that were raised through the presentation of Mr. Sambo. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I will allow if there's any follow-up from the members, but I think we should be noting the fact that says you need to come up with a comprehensive response to the issues, and even in the presence of these members from the different claimants. I think as well you are noting the issue of Advocate Sono. The fact I think even him and the other claimants, because I think all we need here is we must be transparent. If there's a problem, that problem must be clarified and be dealt with in terms of who represents who, what are the different interests. And so I think members would allow that, the response, and members equally would respect the fact that this might be a shared responsibility between our committee and the other committee from agriculture and land reform. Especially, I think we do have a sense now when we talk about pre-settlement and post-settlement and what was done, and this facilitator who had to close the work. I can see some hands, which I assume are follow-ups. Honorable Bryant, followed by Honorable Mbata.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's just with regards to my question around the intentional or the alleged intentional prejudice of land claimants. The presenter did say that, you know, it was something that they had considered, but I didn't hear a commitment one way or the other in terms of whether or not there was a suspicion, in fact, that claimants were intentionally prejudiced. I think this is a very, very important aspect, and I'd like a commitment one way or the other as to, you know, whether that has been ruled out completely of intentional prejudice, or whether or not this is something that's going to be considered for further investigation going forward.
Honourable Mbatha.
Chair.
Yeah.
I think also what needs to be included is the representatives, the legal representatives of these communities. Because you see that there are somehow those that the communities are not happy about the process. And the other thing, I just need clarity because I hear there's a CEO from SANPARK. Are we having a new CEO or what is happening?
Oh, it's the acting CEO.
Oh, acting. Oh, then I'm clear. Because we don't want surprises. We must be informed with the portfolio committee. Thank you. Chair, it's just that we must have a time frame to say when are we going to arrange a meeting with Department of Agriculture, Land and Reform, and also check on the issue of representatives from the community, including their legal representatives, so that when we work on this issue, we work it and finalize it. Thank you.
I thought you would make a proposal first on when the department would come back to us with this comprehensive response.
Let's give them, Chair. Usually, legally, we give them 7 days to work on this and then come back. But I don't know, because if we are supposed to present in Parliament as the plenary, then we have to reduce the time frame. It will be guided to by the presentation that is needed, the debate that is needed in the NA. Thank you.
Okay. Now, I was putting you on the spot, trying to see how we can wind up this. I thought because I can still see the end of Advocate Sono. I thought before I allow the acting CEO, I would again listen to what Advocate Sono would want to say, so that when we're trying to wind up this, we are able to take as well his views. Now, Honorable Modisa, can you come before the acting CEO?
Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity. Ordinarily, it would have been nice to hear the views of Advocate Sono, because I suspect that there is a deliberate crisis that we have been plunged into as the portfolio committee. And some sort of a decision must be taken, and it would either be on the side of the department or on the side of those who were coming across as land claimants and any other person who takes keen interest. So I would really like to hear more or from, if you allow it, from Advocate Sono, so that we are able to make a comprehensive decision as a portfolio committee. But second point, I was going to propose firmly that this coming week, the following week, should not end before we propose a meeting between a joint portfolio committee meeting between ourselves and the portfolio committee on rural development, agriculture, and land. Thanks.
Advocate Sono, can we hear you before we wind up?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the time. I will try to be brief. Chair, these claims were settled under the National Environmental Management Act. And the fact is, all the chairpersons that are now claiming to have a dispute signed this agreement. But before they signed the agreement, they signed the offers. But specifically to speak about the community, not only Madonsi, it is called Mwadzekudzeku Madonsi, the community of Muyeshe, the community of Ndindani, which was not indeed left the PMU. These communities had the joint agreement through the process of scoping, which is a NEMA-initiated process. So indeed, as Mr. Nom Chongwana said, we are about to enter an area where it means claimants are being given an opportunity to review settlements, to change agreement based on either individually changed thought. Now, if the committee has had the opportunity to read the Kruger National Park Beneficiation Scoping Study, as I said, Sono Consulting represented these three communities. Now, when you have chairpersons who were supposed to have been chairpersons of CPAs by now, if they were elected, in a process that has already concluded since 2016, it means the chairpersons have simply continued chairing a process as land claim committees when they were supposed to be CPAs. However, my worry is that if we are to follow the required legislative requirements of NEMA, it means we are about to allow the chairpersons to present a new option without any resolution from communities. And I can tell you, Mr. Sambo has never been to Muyeshe. He has never met with the community of Muyeshe to represent them. And neither can he receive any powers from the chairperson of the Land Claims Committee, because the Land Claims Committee has got no powers, but actually they seized at the time of the settlement. Now, the community of Muyeshe, Mwadzekudzeku Madonsi and Ndindani were represented by ourselves. The reports are there in terms of the economic benefit scoping study. We have got feasibility studies that informed the beneficiation scheme on what the communities of Limpopo were supposed to benefit. We had meetings, as I said, reports which are all available at Sunparks were meetings with DBSA, IDC, Limpopo Economic Development, were set and discussed towards the beneficiation scheme. Now, the reason I questioned Mr. Sambo's submission is that he is about to confirm the non-signing or non-participation of the communities I represented during the settlement process. Having never read my report, having never spoken or asked me on the settlement, having never even been part of any community meetings that happened in Limpopo, I've got all resolutions from 2012 to date on how these claims were settled, on the beneficiation products that were available, on the investment, sustainability, including the development of the Shangoni Gate as a strategic intervention and infrastructure that was identified for the purposes of benefiting communities outside of the Kruger National Park. Now, Mr. Sambo is not tied on land that is owned by the Mwadzekudzeku Madonsi outside of the Kruger National Park. He has not spoken about the land of the Muyeshe mines that are available. He has not spoken about the Ndindani land claim. He has not spoken about co-management offers and discussions that have been had between these communities that were facilitated by the Office of the Regional Land Claims Limpopo between 2012, as I say, to date. Now, finally, Chair, the issue that you raised, the issue of the facilitator. The facilitator, I can clearly say, withdrew after we opposed this appointment. We objected to his qualification. We wrote a letter to the minister, Minister Barbara Creasy, and she responded. And in that response, she indicated that she will refer back to land reform on the appointment of the facilitator. I just want to indicate that the facilitator was not appointed in terms of the NEMA, which would then have made sure that he has got the correct qualification, but there would have been first an administrator before a dispute was issued in terms of NEMA. Therefore, the so-called dispute where a tender was issued for 6 months and a person appointed and later now it is cancelled and the no costs are going to be accrued to anybody. It's just part of a process that in terms of the presidential report on land and agriculture, which is my final submission, It says on page 13, there is no law that obliges the state to provide post-settlement support. And therefore, post-settlement and the structure was simply made as a project to continue benefiting or creating jobs for other people. But indeed, the fact is, it has not benefited the land claimants. The third part, which I believe is the reason why the land claims chairpersons are bitter about the process, is that they themselves, having chaired the process for the last 5 years since settlement, have not been beneficiaries, as they have not been able to form the necessary structure that was required, which is a CPA or a company or an entity that would have been qualified under NEMA to hold the benefits of these communities. I rest. Thank you, Chair.
Advocate Chauke, you are the last now. We are going to see how we get our way forward. Advocate Chauke.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the honourable members, and thank you to the communities that are present in the leadership. I want to dispel some myths, and allow me, Chair, to put certain things in a simpler way so that everybody can able to understand. I want to reply mostly to what Advocate Sono is saying, some of them. But one thing that I want to state categorically clear, I think even Mr. Ngali, I think he represented on behalf of SANPAS, he will able to correct some of the things that Mr. Sono is saying. We had a PMU mechanism that was established in terms of the settlement agreement that was signed in 2016. In this PMU representatives from communities, SANPAS, and other government departments were forming part of this PMU. Mr. Advocate Son never made or was never part of this to represent anybody. I can speak on behalf of Madonsi, which is the community that I'm coming from. That he does not represent us, or he have never represented us. Whether document that he can submit to you, I can tell you that upon your own perusal, you can see that he have never got a mandate from anybody, or even if he got a mandate from anybody, that person was not representing a Madonsi in that particular order. Other communities can able to speak for themselves, but for my community, which is Madonsi, they have never represented us. They have no document to prove. I have requested him on several occasions to say produce documents which you allege that they've given you a mandate to present to represent Madonsi. Even today, the people who have signed those documents, they've never represented Madonsi. When he say that the independent facilitator that was appointed withdraw because of the weather pressure or anything that they've disputed him, it's not correct. The correct position is what Mr. Nom Chong Wai has mentioned, Mr. Ngani, that he have left because his contract, which was 6 months, nobody will have forced him to come back to the process to represent communities in the facilitated process. He withdrew. And now there are options which are being explored by the commission, which, of course, we raised an issue with that. I think we had a meeting as community representative on the 4th of August with Dr. Anton van Padde, who mentioned to us that the independent facilitator, Mr. Memeza, is no longer going to proceed. And now, as the commission, we're exploring other avenues, which, of course, it might have been to appoint a retired judge and take this matter to the Land Claims Court for an order. So that we can settle this matter, yeah, beneficiation scheme. So those are the things that we're saying. But in terms of Mr. Sambu representing today, Mr. Sambu put it, I think maybe the chair, you might not have followed it up. There's a chairperson of Madonsi, as we know, which is Wilson Jao, is part of this meeting. He agreed. We have spoken to Dr. Tungwan, who is the chairperson of Miege. Is being represented by Edith Paul, who's part of this meeting. to confirm that we said Sambo proceed. There is Fakude, there is people from all five communities, as you have mentioned. It's unfortunate that Son, Mr. Sono, when he proceeded or you given him the podium, he wants Sambo to identify himself to this commission, as he hasn't done so. Who is he representing in this meeting today? Because his community, which is Ndindan, he withdrew from the engagement of the project management unit. Today, which community is he representing? Is he part, is he a chairperson of state? Because this meeting was called for chairpersons. Which chairperson is he holding today? So whatever, like Mr. Gwazile mentioned, he's having an agenda, and the agenda that is here is just to disrupt this proceedings. And I think he was not even supposed to be allowed to attend this particular meeting, because I don't know which community is he representing. Thank you, Chair.
No, I said you are the last, and honorable members, I'm not opening this for discussion. Would allow the acting CEO, where is he now? The acting CEO was supposed to respond to, but I allowed this discussion because I think we wanted to know exactly Advocate Sono's contention, as was indicated by Honorable Modiste. I think from now on we'll be able to see how best we manage the process going forward. So, but I see many hands. Maybe before I allow the acting CEO, Honorable Mbata.
Chair, just thank you,
quickly,
Chair.
We're trying to get to the way forward now.
Chair, yeah. Briefly. Yes. I foresee a problem here. We need to investigate who is representing those communities, because now Advocate Chauke is saying Advocate Sono is not part of this. But when we were there, Advocate Sono was representing some other traditional leaders that were there. So it's really confusing what is happening here. We might end up with a bomb that will be of danger to us. We need to investigate this on our own and get the actual facts, what is happening there. Because you can't say to a person who was in a meeting and was representing some traditional leaders, who was there, and you say now that person is not part and parcel. We will be trapped.
I think we're noting that, Honorable Mbata. I would suggest that even ourselves now, let's have this joint meeting with the Department of Agriculture and Land Reform, where we can clarify ourselves as well on this. And anybody who has got any documents, when I say anybody, either Advocate Sono, any document that can clarify us, let that be submitted to us, or Advocate So. When I say Pambo, now Sambo, any documents that could clarify as to who represents what. And beyond that, I think we'll then have to find a way to clarify ourselves between ourselves and the community, guided by the Department of Agriculture and Land Reform as well, as to who actually represent those communities. So let's not discuss it yet. But Honorable Modise. We're trying to craft the way forward, yes.
Yes, correct, Chairperson. That is where I want to come in. And Chair, I must also appreciate that you gave me a bit of time and allowed, I think, Advocate Sono to make whatever input he made, which was subsequently countered by Advocate Chauke. So we find ourselves in a battle of advocates. Very soon they'll start speaking their jargon and might find ourselves in court. I'm going to first lobby you to suppress them as we make a way forward. Two, that we cannot find ourselves in this situation as the overseers of the developmental aspects and the work that has to be discharged by the department. And we must never mince our words in so saying that we are giving the department latest five working days to compile a comprehensive report on the prevailing conditions that relates to this particular quagmire in the Kruger National Park. Next week, when we convene a meeting, Honorable Chairperson, with the Department of Rural Development, the department must have presented to us their findings so that as and when we intervene as a portfolio committee or the joint portfolio committees, as and when we intervene in this situation in Kruger National Park, we have received the report of what exactly is happening. We can't sit here, Chairperson, and say Ntibi Mudise is representing Mazingi Zingi and whatever else, and Figile Plaza is representing whoever else, because we are not conversant with the situation there. So we give the department 5 working days to compile us a report of what is happening there. By the time we meet with Rural Development and Land Reform, we have interfaced with that report so that we resolve as joint committees on how we're going to resolve the what seems to be a quagmire, as opposed to us being clouded by what one can just simply call a land political battle surrounding the Kruger National Park. Chairperson, I want to thank you for that. Thank you very much.
Before we conclude, I will allow the acting CEO, if there were any issues raised by members that we might not have responded to. Otherwise, we are taking your proposals and the Deputy Minister that we allow you time to go back and help us to be clear about what is happening here so that we might be able to must diagnose properly the problem and suggest proper solution. Acting CEO.
Thank you very much, Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. I think the outstanding question was the question of Honorable Brian. And I wanted to perhaps respond in two ways, to say that at Sunparks, we want to categorically state that we did not intentionally prejudice communities and that are part of the land claimants. And we also, secondly, Chair, would welcome any independent investigation to establish whether you know, that was the case, and if there are any members of staff of Sunparks who may have been involved in sowing discord among communities, so that we can then take appropriate actions. But as far as we are aware, as management, we have not intentionally tried to cause or to prejudice communities as far as this is concerned. We actually have or want to support communities to benefit quite significantly. And when we do get the opportunity to reply, we will present the proposed beneficiation scheme from the Sunparks point of view, which is the post-settlement arrangement that would have allowed communities to get benefits in some of the development opportunities within the Kruger National Park, including Skukuza Lodge. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. Now, in summary, I think we would want to get that comprehensive response from the department. It must take into account, from your perspective, it would help us as well to have a sense as to who represents what and what are the contestations. And I think we noted the fact that you were more focused on the post-settlement, the pre-settlement, the Department of Agriculture and Land Reform might have been central, and I'm sure when we want to engage them, would also want to understand that. And the issue of the facilitator, I think you can as well clarify that if these two people who spoke here have got different perspectives, there must be one from the government. I think the issue of time frames is up to you if you think you might not be able to meet that. It is obviously what is coming out. Honorable Mbatha said 7 days. If you have a problem with that, would be happy, because we also didn't want to prolong this process. There are many other things we are engaged in. But let's close this session, not this session, this topic at this point. We are running out of time now. Can I ask Deputy Minister to help us now move to the last presentation, and it be brief.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks for those closing remarks. I think we will, as the Minister, work very closely with the SANParks management in order for us then to come up with a credible report when it comes to the issue that we're discussing. Now, Chairperson, I will then request Dr. Ziba, the acting CEO, to lead us on the SANParks fourth quarter performance report and the financial report 2020-2021. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister. Chair, we will be presenting our fourth quarter report as well as the financial report for 2020-2021. May I request to move to the next slide and then another slide? Next one, please. Thank you, Chair. I think I want to summarize a few key challenges that we have experienced in the past year, and then, Chair, focus on the reds and the yellows, and then take the report as read, and welcome the CFO to then present the financial report. And once we are done, Chair, we will welcome questions from members on the parts that we would have presented or any other part of the report. Chair, one of the key challenges that we experience related to the impact of the pandemic on the financial resources generally in the country, which led to budget cuts, which impacted on the APP. And hence, we had to review during our midterm review the APP and try to realistically align it to the budgets and the time that remained in the year, because we were basically as a country on lockdown for most part of the first two quarters of the year. Chair, we suffered major revenue losses as a result of restrictions brought by the pandemic and the national lockdowns. And while some of the restrictions were relaxed, they were not entirely removed, having impact in some cases on interprovincial travel or on international visitors, with major consequences for SANParks, which generates significant revenue from ecotourism. For instance, a number of visitors dropped by about 68% visitors to national parks. A number of international visitors who usually spend a significant amount of time in our concession partners declined by 98%, Chair. And as a result, this all impacted on revenues generated by SANParks from ecotourism. We do though want to acknowledge the support we received from government with regards to a special grant that helped us be able to pursue essential services, in particular to complete the financial year. We did experience significant human resource capacity constraints, mainly chair with the fact that many staff members had to work from home, and as a result, of sometimes comorbidities and therefore being unable to come to work, and also absenteeism that was related to isolation periods. But we also experienced other challenges that related with making sure that when staff were working from home, they were adequately equipped. As we know, the pandemic came upon us rather suddenly, and we had to make changes and adapt as quickly as possible in order to respond to some of the challenges. We also had major limitations on filling vacant posts due to financial constraints, and this impacted in aspects of our business. Next slide, please. Chair, this is an overall performance picture for the year relating to outcome goal number one on sustainable biodiversity and cultural heritage across land and sea delivers benefits to people of South Africa and the world now and in the future. Like, Chair, that outcome had 82% on target, 9% in progress, and 9% off target. But similarly, we were able to achieve all of the targets that were revised targets in the responsible tourism outcome goal number two. The outcome goal related to socioeconomic development, which also was revised substantially, we achieved 92% of our targets, Chair. And then outcome goal four on sustainable and transformed organization through revenue, people systems and business processes, we achieved 78% of our target. Overall, 84% on target, 7% work in progress, and 9% off target. Next slide, please. So, Chair, next slide, please. If we can go to the yellows, I'd appreciate that. Thank you very much. Chair, this is the first target that was not achieved, and so work in progress. It is around the number of degraded hectares of land. This target and the next target, Chair, relates to rehabilitation. Here in this target, we deal with initial rehabilitation where we clear invasive alien species. In the next target, we deal with follow-up rehabilitation. When we had the delays relating to the first 2 months, we also had constraints financially that made it such that we were not able to initiate rehabilitation for the good part of last year. But when we received the Presidential Employment Stimulus Fund in November, we were then able to push a lot of work in the fourth quarter to try and achieve the revised target of 9,546, but we only achieved 7,880 initial hectares, Chair. But if you look at the next slide on the number of degraded hectares of land rehabilitated, which is follow-up rehabilitation, Chair, we overachieved in this target by delivering 78,600 hectares against the target of 61,000 hectares. And the main reason for this, Chair, was that we had to focus the crews to deal with follow-up rehabilitation following the Cape Region wildfires, because once you have wildfires, then there's usually a resprouting of a lot of invasive alien plants that then require that we respond. We also put in additional work to deal with an invasive plant called Parthenium in Kruger, which was causing major problems. And so, Chair, this is an explanation of the why the previous target was yellow, but that we actually over emphasized dealing with follow-up rehabilitation. Can we go to the next yellow or red? Thank you, Chair. This is another important annual target regarding percentage annual increase in rhino populations. Chair, this target is in two parts. The first part dealing with the decline in rhino population in Kruger, halted, and the second part dealing with the population in other rhino parks increasing at a minimum of 4%. Chair, we are pleased to report that in the other rhino parks managed by SANParks, the annual growth rate was actually 7.3%, which exceeded the target. However, Chair, the decline in both the black and white rhino populations in Kruger has not been halted, and poaching continues to be a major driver. And we also, Chair, when we looked closely at the numbers, we realized that we still are experiencing a lag effect of the 2015-2016 drought on birth rates of white rhinos. And we also see the disturbance of the black rhino social structure also resulting in lower birth rates since 2013. And this part relates mainly to the fact that as poaching like sometimes kills disproportionately like females in the case of black rhino, you have more males in the population, and they tend to fight more and breed less, and that affects then the birth rates of the population. But we are looking at major interventions to try and deal, Chair, with both poaching, but also with creating sustainable populations in the other rhino parks, so that we can compensate for the losses that we are suffering due to poaching in Kruger. Next slide, please. Thank you, Chair. This one relates to the percentage of expenditure on affirmative procurement, and we had planned to spend about 65% on BBBEE, Chair, and we only achieved 61% of our target. Chair, we 61%. We wanted to indicate here, Chair, that we had a major limitation because basically we didn't do much business during quarters one and two because of the lockdown. But also, by and large, we are dealing with a sector in the conservation and tourism Chair, where transformation lags, and as a result, sometimes a lot of companies don't meet our BBBEE requirements for some of the tenders that we advertise. But Chair, we are working on strategies to develop enterprises, especially emerging micro enterprises or qualifying small enterprises with designated groups such as women, youth, and previously disadvantaged groups. Next slide, please. Let's continue to move to another yellow. Yes, right. Thank you, Chair. We also did not meet the target around the percentage of people among our staff with disabilities. And we had aimed to have a staff complement at least 1.5% of people with disabilities. And Chair, we only achieved 1.1% of this target. We only achieved 1.1%. And this was mainly due to the fact that, Chair, we believe that there are staff members who qualify but might not be aware or might not necessarily have the necessary document to verify their disability disclosure, because that is one of the verification requirements by the Auditor General. And so we had planned awareness campaigns through roadshows in order to help staff to understand this and also to assist staff with getting doctors' verification on their disability disclosures. But again, the impact of restrictions to travel and also the need to and limitations that we had financially to be able to engage in some of these roadshows limited our ability to do this. But this is something that, Chair, as conditions permit, we hope we will be able to address. Next slide, please. Thank you. We did achieve, Chair, the part of ensuring that we have an ethics strategy and policy that is approved, but there were activities or one activity that we were not able to implement, resulting in us achieving less than 95% implementation as planned. And this was the fraud risk assessment that we had planned, but because of the consultations required in order to complete this, we were not able to do this on time. But I am aware that a lot of this work has been undertaken in the current financial year, Chair. Thank you. Next slide, please. The next slide, Chair, relates to the percentage execution of the internal audit plan. We had aimed to achieve 50%, but only achieved 33% of the amended internal audit plan. This was mainly due to capacity challenges in internal audit. We had a core-sourced internal audit service provider, but their contract ended towards the end of the last financial year, and we were not able to appoint a panel of internal auditors as was recommended by the board. But I am pleased to inform the committee chair that this has since panel of internal auditors has since been appointed, and we hope that this matter will not be a challenge going forward. Next slide, please. Again, the internal audit had to implement a number of corrective actions, and the plan was to implement 50% corrective actions, and that self-assessments would be conducted. 60% of the corrective actions were implemented. However, the self-assessment was not conducted, I am aware that these have since been addressed by the internal audit team, Chair. Thank you. Next slide, please. Chair, now I would like to hand over to Mr. Tumisane Dlamini, our Chief Financial Officer, to please take us through the financial report for 2020-21 financial year, Chair. Over to you, CFO.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, Deputy Minister and colleagues. Thank you for this opportunity. Next slide. It's a very busy slide, Honorable Chairperson, but in a nutshell, it indicates that we had actually projected that we'll have a deficit of about over 500 million at the end of the financial year due to the low generation of revenue because of the pandemic. However, by the end of the financial year, we only had a deficit of 94.8 million, which then represent an improvement of over 400 million in our financial situation. Next slide. So the revenue that we generated is 2.4 billion, which is lower than the previous year where we've generated over 3 billion in that particular financial year. It's still 322 million more than the budget that we had indicated, thanks to the easing of lockdown, which has enabled our park to have a minimal commercial activities, and we're able to generate money in addition to the financial assistance that we've received from the department. Next slide. Part of what we've been driving in the organization in order to assist the situation was a significant drive on cost saving. We have saved over 400 million in cost throughout the organization, spending from employee-related costs all the way to operation. We've also negotiated payment extension with certain service providers, which also lowered our costs for this particular financial year. Next slide. We received 193 million of the presidential employment stimulus, which we actually divided into two parts. One was for ecosystem under rehabilitation, and there was 183 million that was allocated. And the second portion of that was for infrastructure maintenance as well as upgrade, which was 110 million allocated. We are pleased to inform the portfolio committee that the first part, which was 83 million, we have fully utilized the allocation for that amount, and it's been spent on all those projects which are showing on the screen, including working on water, working on wetland, as well as the eco-finisher as an implementation agent of the department. Next slide. In relation to infrastructure and maintenance, we will not be able to complete the all allocation by 31st March. However, in the new financial year, we have now not only committed this amount, but also fully spent it, which we spend it by the first quarter of the new financial year. As it indicated, we've been able to create about 950 job opportunities, 33 SMEs supported. We've been able to deal with issues of solar heaters installed in our staff accommodation, as well as almost 10,000 LED lights throughout all our park, and mainly those parks which are mentioned in the in this particular slide. Next slide. With this money, we've been able to, in overall for both amount, delivered over 4,000 employment opportunities to communities around our park. More than 500 SMEs were supported. Land which was rehabilitated was over 2,000 hectares, almost 3,000 hectares, and the follow-up land was almost 60,000 hectares, including wet rehabilitation of wetland of almost 3,000 cubic centimeters. We just wanted to show the portfolio committee some of the work which has been done using the same money. We didn't want to show Kruger National Park because some of those accommodation and infrastructure, the committee have seen it during the oversight visit, but this is just to show some of the areas, including the Kimberley Game Capture Unit, which has also been renovated using these funds. Next slide. So if we come to annual financial statement, these are the results. You will notice that from this particular slide that our tourism income has actually dropped from 2.4 billion to about 1,935,000. Our visitors, because of this, they've actually dropped from 7 million 2 years ago to 6.3 million in the previous year. And the year that we're actually dealing with, we only had 1.9 million visitors. As you can see, that has actually significantly impacted in the revenue that is generated. We want to express our gratitude again to the department for assisting us. As you can see, that the grant for this particular financial year has really picked up in order to complement and help us to be able to meet mainly our expenditure obligation. Despite cost curtailment that we've implemented, we still had a deficit of just under 100 million, moving down from the surplus that we had in the previous year, which is a pre-COVID financial year. Next slide. So this is a balance sheet of Sun Park. As you can see, that our assets had dropped by from 5.8 billion to about 5.4. Also, our spending represented by liabilities have actually decreased from 1.6 billion to 1.4. This mainly representing many of the projects that we had an opportunity to actually implement it during the lockdown, as can be seen by those figures actually decreasing. Means that those amount that we'd received from the department has put as a liability where we had an aggressive spending on most of them, even though that we have delayed some of the project. Next slide. This is a cash flow statement of Sun Park. What I want to highlight in this particular slide is that we ended the year 2020 with 1.8 billion cash resources. There was an increase in our cash resources because we had a good year in that particular year of about just under 700 million. But if you notice what happened in this particular year under review, even though the cash resources were about 2.5 billion, but the organization has lost over 300 million worth of cash because of inability to generate revenue. Most of the cash that we would have received is really related to infrastructure and money that we've received. Hence, it's showing as cash and cash equivalent at the end of the financial year. Next slide. This is quite a very interesting picture because it shows that in that bar chart, 62% of the revenue was really received from government, while 33% was really come from commercial activities. And you can see that this is a new switch as opposed to the previous year, where orange is usually higher than gray, because there's more money that is generated by the organization rather than what is being received from government. Next slide. I think the biggest part that we have is our fixed cost. As you can see from this pie chart, that 52% of our expenditure goes to people. We have more than 4,000 staff at Sun Park and a payroll of about 1.3 billion. This represents 52% of the total expenditure within the organization. The next highest cost is operating cost, including the project. This represents about 42% of the total expenditure. As you can see, that if you include projects, it's just over 1 billion in this particular financial year. Next slide. This is a picture that shows the state of our balance sheet in a summary, what is the state of our net asset all the way to our non-current liabilities. Next slide. So in terms of our net asset, we are pleased to indicate that it takes us 29 days to settle our account. For the smaller entities like SMMEs, we're striving towards paying them within 15 days so that we make sure that they don't struggle on cash. Where we have a challenge is really the collection of debt, in particular concessionaire. As you can see that it takes us about 61 days on average to be able to collect the cash. We have about most of our concessionaire who have been struggling because of COVID. They're unable to pay at least even minimum rental for the facilities which they actually have rented from Sunpark in order to generate revenue. They've been affected by the pandemic, and most of them have actually applied for first major. The amount that they were owing us by 31st March was about 52 million, and it's very much likely that they won't be able to pay that amount in the near future, given that the tourism industry is depressed. So we are likely to see this amount being written off rather than being recoverable. Our balance sheet still remains strong. As you can see, the current ratio is 1.62:1, which means most of our current assets can cover our liabilities at this stage. Next slide. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. We will take guidance from members and you, and also accept questions.
Already, it's those old hands. Advocate Sono, I must lower your hand. I assume Honorable Modise, you are number one, unless it's the old hand. Honorable Weber, you are number one. Honorable Modise has lowered his hand. Honorable Phillips, Honorable Bryant, can we get Honorable Verbe?
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. I would like to ask, I think the first thing I would like to say is that I would like to have a much more clear distinction between the black rhinos and the white rhinos. We speak about white rhinos most often, but the black rhino is really endangered. And we get very little information about the black rhino. We hear that fight, but in the beginning of the year, when the Sandbox report came out, it was basically 3,500 white rhino left and 265 black rhino. And that is a very, very minimum number. And they are also poached because it is actually their horn that is more popular than the white rhino. So my question is, I would like to have more information on the black rhino, where we really stand with them, where their birth rates are, because the focus is only on white rhino, and we sort of forget the black rhino, which is actually really endangered. Then my second question is, what will the corrective action be to ensure that in KNP the rhino don't become extinct? Because currently, out of the 250 rhino poaching, the target referred to represents 7% of the last census. So it is higher than the current rate of 6% of birth. Now, I see you say it is picking up in the other national parks, but colleagues, we need to understand that KNP is our majority of white rhinos, and the others can't lift up that we become above that target. So I really would like to know what the corrective action is and how we're going to fight this, because this is very important. Then I would like to ask Mr. Dumisani Dlamini, I know you're the CFO. Recently in Skukuza, you had a private doctor there for many years. Now, listening to the and watching your report talking about, you know, COVID has taken quite a lot of things away from people and it struggles. And I see you say you have a vacant, you struggle to fill your vacancies, etc., and that you are underspending on your unemployment-related costs. But here's my question. How is it that you would let a private doctor that's been working there for years, let him go and then create a post for a doctor with no equipment? So my question is, where is the money for this equipment coming from? Where is the budget for this appointed doctor? As some folks said, I had to pay the doctor. And why would this have been done if we're really struggling financially, as you say? And why would you create a new post for one that is already existing, where no equipment, no salary, nothing was costing you anything? Thank you very much.
Honorable Phillips.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you so much for the presentation. I have a number of concerns and I hope they can be answered. I just would like to echo what my colleague and Honourable Weber has said about the Kruger Park Rhino. We cannot just discount them and say that we can make it up in other parks. It's totally unacceptable. We need a plan of action that actually works, please. But my questions are, who oversees the setting of the KPIs? These KPIs are very, very soft and seem to be very easy to achieve. On page 9, how many hectares of degraded land is there that we actually need to rehabilitate? Not how many you've done. I'd like to know how many hectares we need to rehabilitate. On page 11, I'd also know what the actual size of the wetlands is that needs to be rehabilitated. And how are our annual targets set? I mean, the amount of wetland that was rehabilitated is a piece roughly 100 meters by 50 meters. I've got a team in Rustenburg that can do that in about a month. So that seems totally unsuccessful to me. We're never going to get everything rehabilitated if that's the pace that is being worked at. So, yeah, I would like to know how these targets, these annual targets are set. And I'd also like to know who oversees the setting of these targets. Thank you very much.
Honorable Bryant.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, you know, listening to the presentation, and I, you know, there's certain aspects of the Sanparks presentation which, you know, do make one feel hopeful for the future, but when it comes to the issue around rhinos, I think we have to accept the fact that it appears that Sanparks has just accepted the fact that rhinos are going to go extinct and that they will lose all their rhinos in Kruger National Park, because there doesn't seem to be a real sense of urgency in terms of conserving and preserving the rhinos within the boundaries of Kruger National Park. And I think the clearest indication of this is the fact that there is a refusal still to set a zero target for the number of rhinos being poached. The fact that it's even considered to be okay to set a target of less than 250 rhinos to be poached is abhorrent, to be honest with you. If you look at the private farms and you look at the reserves that are managed privately, they have zero target. They don't have targets that, well, you know, we'll let a certain number of our rhino, this critically endangered animal, we'll allow a certain number of them to be poached. It's not acceptable. The target should be zero. And if Sanparks are not managing to comply and are not managing to keep those targets at zero, then they need to be continually marked as red. It is not acceptable for us to be setting such a low bar in terms of the poaching of rhino. Just in terms of some of the other questions, and you know, just one more thing when it comes to the rhino. We were also promised during our site visits that the polygraph testing was going to be aggressively pursued going forward. I haven't heard anything else about how far along that is. And, you know, it's a central aspect of addressing rhino poaching, and I know a lot of it is connected to the HR processes. As I understand, the HR has now been contracted to an external service provider, and I'd like to know whether or not that's having any impact on the polygraph testing itself, and what the other potential constraints are that are being caused by the HR capacity issues. Then, Chairperson, I just had another question, which I found was a bit strange. 9.3, they speak about the establishment of the Rhodes Memorial Tea Room and its great success. My understanding is that that was burnt down during the fires earlier in the year, and I just want to know whether that's been factored in and how that will be processed going forward. On 14.3, it was mentioned that a target of 50 schools are going to visit the national parks. It's not a very low number. We have a lot of schools and we have a lot of children who could benefit from being given access to these parks and building that into their own understanding of the country and conservation going forward. I think one of the challenges that we have is too few people know and are able to experience the wonderful diversity of wildlife that we have in our country. Chairperson, I think for now that is it for me. Thank you.
Honorable Singh.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. I think the rhino question and poaching has been exhausted, save for me to ask whether Sandparks is aware of any cases pending before the courts, any staff who have been implicated, and what disciplinary procedures have been taken with staff who are allegedly involved in poaching. My second question would relate to trying to increase the number of occupants at our parks. Is there any kind of incentivization for members of the public to come to our parks, discounted rates, or you get a discount if you are vaccinated, or some kind of aggressive marketing and incentivization? And the last question would relate to additional COVID funding. We do know that Sandparks was one of the beneficiaries of additional funding last year sometimes. And I just want to know if spending of that money is on track and have we been able to achieve the objectives for which those funds were granted to Sandparks. Thank you.
Honorable Deputy Minister and the team, can we respond?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks to members of Parliament. Chairperson, the acting CEO and the team will respond to those questions that has been raised by honorable members, and I think this is our last presentation of the day. I believe that acting CEO, you will be in a position then of responding to those questions as raised by members. But Chairperson, maybe I should indicate that when it comes to the performance, as you could remember that the people, this issue of the disability, I think even the last quarter we were in red and we are still in red. As you know that there are changes with regard to government when it comes to that, because people had to have proof from a doctor to show that they are indeed disabled. And this is coming very slowly in. Therefore, we are struggling to get it right because of the process is very slow. But otherwise, the CEO, acting CEO, will then respond to those questions and his team. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair and Honourable Deputy Minister. I want to take some of the questions and then we'll have my colleagues who are part of the meeting chair to also address some. The first question that relates, Chair, to Black Rhino. We want to acknowledge to Honourable Weber that indeed Black Rhino numbers are much lower than those of White Rhino. But what we have, Chair, is that for Black Rhino, like in Kruger, we only have the South Central Black Rhino. And in the other parks, We have the other subspecies, which is the southwestern black rhino. And Chair, what is important to note is that both white and black rhino numbers are increasing in the other parks, even though the numbers are generally very low. So as part of the interventions that we are implementing, which we would be more than welcome to come and give a more detailed presentation together with some of our partners around some of the proposed interventions, Chair. We are aware that the challenge of rhino poaching in Kruger is big, Chair. And we have presented in our last annual report the fact that the numbers of rhino in Kruger have been declining over the last decade. And it is something that is not due to lack of effort or investment by government. As an example, Chair, we are investing on anti-poaching activities in the Kruger National Park more than 250 million rands per annum. And we have many interventions, including technologies, gunshot sensors. We have rangers. We have got canine units. We have we have an internal investigating unit. We have the air wing that responds. We collaborate with law enforcement agencies. We even have members or a unit of the army that is based in Kruger that is helping with some of the work that deals with anti-poaching. So it is not out of lack of effort, but rather out of the enormity of the challenges that we are facing, including the role of international syndicates in facilitating poaching. But Chair, we also have recognized the fact that proximity to high density human settlements creates a challenge, Chair, because poachers leave the park and quickly disappear in the communities. And this is not a fault of the communities, but rather poachers taking advantage of the fact that they can do their business and quickly disappear. Chair, what we want to highlight is that our interventions that we are looking at are looking at creating sanctuaries, both in Kruger, but also outside Kruger. The fact is that we are not creating alternative populations outside of Kruger that have got significant rhino numbers of both black and white rhino, we will not be able to change the trajectory in terms of the decline in the rhino population. And this is something that we want to address. Chair, the next question that I want to address relates also to rhino, which is the question raised by Honorable Bryant. And to say, why don't we set a zero target? One of the approaches to setting targets is basically setting targets that are specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, Chair, and time bound. So it is not realistic in Kruger National Park to set a zero target for rhinos that are poached when we know for a fact that poaching activity is quite rife. The only time we got a reprieve from incursions into the park was during level 5 lockdown when there was no movement allowed whatsoever. Otherwise, during other times, on a daily basis, we have multiple incursions. So I think it would be good to sort of see the target setting in this regard, not necessarily as that Sanparks wishes that there are 250 rhinos poached, but that realistically, at the height of rhino poaching, there were more than 800 rhinos poached in Kruger. But that number we have reduced, but we have also acknowledged the fact that the rhino population has declined and hence the interventions that we are talking about. Also, we want to emphasize that if you look at our other rhino parks, which in size are comparable to the private nature reserves that Honorable Brian is talking about. We've actually lost about 5 rhinos in the last 5 years. So the significant numbers of rhinos that are poached are in Kruger National Park. And we have a very minimal rhino poaching problem in the other parks, which when complemented by the growth rates of the rhino population in those parks, continues to increase the number of rhino in the other parks. For instance, in 2012, we had 287 both black and white rhino in the other parks. And in 2020, that number was 679 rhinos. So we are definitely seeing growth in the other parks, whereas we are seeing a decline in Kruger. And that is why we're talking about creating sustainable populations in other areas outside Kruger. The question around that Honorable Phillips asked, I will ask Ms. McCaw to respond to, as well as the polygraph testing question. I will also ask Ms. Mr. Gareth Coleman to address that. I will ask Mr. Nomchongwana to address the question around schools visitations during this period, but to highlight the fact that this past year we had to substantially revise our targets down because basically there was nothing happening during the first two quarters of the year due to lockdowns, but also group activities such as having school buses were not ideal, and hence the numbers were substantially revised in our annual performance plan, Chair. I would also ask Mr. Gareth Coleman to deal with the questions around cases and staff who have been disciplined related to rhino poaching. The last question relating to number of occupants in national parks. Chair, we're doing our best with regards to marketing and advertising of our national parks. And in fact, during periods when travel is permitted, we have seen people go back and visit our national parks. But what is interesting, especially before vaccination, what we are seeing is that people are preferring to camp and do activities where they can either be by themselves or with their families. And we want to hope, Chair, that with the vaccination program, and hopefully perhaps that we can avoid a fourth wave, that we will start to see recovery and hopefully start to see again the number of international visitors growing. But this is something that is quite paramount for our recovery as an organization. We are not unfortunately uniquely affected by this. Other like institutions in the tourism sector have also been similarly affected, Chair, and we are hoping for quicker recovery once you know the vaccination program has taken root, Chair. May I hand over to my colleagues, maybe starting with Ms. McCaw, and then the colleagues can decide how they and starting with Ms. McCaw, Mr. Coleman, and Mr. Nomchongwana. Thank you, Chair.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, colleagues, Honourable Deputy Minister. I will be responding to two of the questions. The first from Honourable Phillips around the natural resource management program, that is the rehabilitation of degraded land, the clearance of aliens. Just to explain that this sandbox is what we used to call an implementing agent of the national Natural Resource Management Program that forms part of the Expanded Public Works programs in South Africa. So the work, the scientific work that informs what is done during the year is run through the SANBI, the South African National Biological Institution, together with the NRM team at the department, who then maps all of these areas that require rehabilitation, prioritize them, and then according to the resources available in terms of the EPWP program, resources are allocated to the different implementing agents to then work on the areas that have been identified in terms of the bigger program of the country. I do not have the exact hectares that has been identified in land managed by Sandparks available, but we can certainly follow up with the department and we can quantify that for Sandparks in the current medium-term strategic framework, the implementation. So the resources available through the expanded public work program and working with a labor-intensive methodology is determining the hectares that is being targeted in these prioritized areas based on science. In terms of the second question that I would be responding to, Mr. Coleman will be responding to the current situation on polygraph testing highlighted by Honorable Bryant. Just to understand that currently in terms of the legislative framework available to us, polygraph testing can only be conducted on a voluntary basis. We are currently working with the different parties and the different authorities to see whether we can have a policy position that can, in certain circumstances and for certain type of positions, provide us to have a mandatory polygraph testing and also potential lifestyle audits, etc., to go with that. But my colleague, Mr. Coleman, will expand on the current practice. In terms of, Honorable Singh, your question around the cases currently before the court, we do have some information, but of course this is just in terms of cases where in our own investigation teams were part of the partnerships. We do not have the full role, court role, etc., and sentences in terms of all areas of rhino poaching that is before the court. We just have anecdotal feedback on the cases where we allege evidence or where we were involved in it. In those cases, we can provide what the ultimate sentences were that came out. In terms of staff involvement in rhino poaching, we do have a very dedicated process in order to prevent, detect, and then investigate and deal with it. In addition to the, of course, the criminal investigation, which is referred to the relevant authorities, we do have a disciplinary process in place for alleged involvement in rhino poaching, and where through the fair and just disciplinary process, it is on the balance of probability proven that there has been such involvement. We are dealing with it in accordance with our disciplinary code, and this is a Category 1 offence, which is immediately dismissible. In this instance, in the past year, two of those cases did conclude, and there was actually dismissals of employees as a result of alleged involvement in rhino poaching. And in one of those instances, it was before the court cases have been concluded in that matter. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. I would suggest now, I know that you are ready to respond to all the questions, but equally, I know that those who are raising questions, they do have some sense of responses they expect from you. We are running out of time. There's plenary at 14 hours. We are supposed to have stopped at 1:30. So I would plead with everybody, if there's anything that you think the honorable members need to know beyond what you have said, let's find other means to communicate that. Honorable members, that's my plea to say we should stop at this stage, Deputy Minister, and prepare for plenary. If you all agree, but as a Democrat, if there's anybody who has got a serious objection, I'll take that. But if you don't raise your hand, I'm going to adjourn the meeting. I'm proposing to adjourn the meeting at this stage.
Chairperson, it's Honourable Bryant here. Chairperson, I completely understand where you're coming from with the request. My only concern is that often we don't get, you know, the responses to the questions when we ask for them in a written format. And I think that there are some outstanding points, you know, that could be raised. Can I just ask at least if we can just have Mr. Coleman conclude this particular aspect of it, and then perhaps the others can maybe be sent through. If you could grant us another 5 minutes.
No, let's take Mr. Coleman.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members and the Deputy Minister. I won't deal with all the issues. I think perhaps just one, a commitment to understanding to the part, to the members of the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee, that I think every single ranger and probably almost every single employee in KNP and those who are responsible in Sandparks are seized with the challenge of rhino poaching. And I think it worries every rhino that dies. It is of concern, certainly to us in the park and to the Sandparks leadership. I'm not sure if members are fully appreciative of the challenges we face. I think in 2020, we had over 1,600 incursions into the park. You can do the maths as to how many incursions happen on a daily basis. So it's a huge challenge. There's more that can be done. We are certainly investigating ways to improve our performance. We are obviously also challenged with the shortage of funds in that area, but we are working with Sandparks and I think also with the department and trying to find solutions and to raise funding to give support, especially in those areas where our rhinos are concentrated in the park. We deal with it literally on a daily basis. I think similarly with the integrity testing, with the polygraph testing, we have in the last few months held many discussions internally with the rangers and externally with advisors to private parks as well as with the CCMA about the process we can follow. I'm not going to repeat what the COO said, but that's exactly the case. We're trying to find ways in which it can be mandatory for polygraph testing and how that might and what types of action we can take with regard to that. It's not a simple question. We don't want to implement something which is going to backfire on us, but I can assure the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee members that everybody within the leadership of Sandparks is totally committed to dealing with that issue. I think the final issue was with respect to the Skukuza doctors. There are a number of questions to it, but perhaps just to respond with what the situation was and is. Sandparks has always paid the medical doctors within the Kruger National Park for a certain set of services. In other words, they've always received, you could probably call it a retainer, but that's in order to provide medical emergency services, as well as to provide some occupational support to staff, as well as to make sure that all our camps are properly, have adequate medical bags at their disposal. Nothing has changed except the fact that the previous doctors who were providing that service are no longer providing that service. We are currently about to go out on a five-year process. We're revising the manner in which we look at the provision of these services in Kruger to make sure that we are responsible primarily around occupational health issues and emergency issues, and that we are responsible for ensuring that the well-being of our employees in that area. But the budgets which have been assigned to those medical services essentially remain the same as have always been in the past. We just have another doctors on a short-term contract whilst we finalise the longer-term procurement. I think this is also the subject of a parliamentary question and there will be a full response to that. And I'm also happy to give the committee full information. Thank you.
Thank you. That then concludes our business for the day. Honourable members, thank you, Deputy Minister and DG and team. Thank you, honorable members. Thank you to the other presenters. It was a long day, but I think it was worth it. The meeting is adjourned.